General Government Committee Subcommittee to order. We have the first item on the agenda is Secretary of State Special Election Costs. Bill, you want to chat with us just a tad?
Yeah, if I could be joined by my elections director, John Lindbach, that would be great.
No.
Yes on the joining and no on the great.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State. This can be a very quick item. Last session appropriated $1.5 million for the special election that was held in September. Okay? We're here today asking you for $1.3 million to pay for that special election. So the good news is that it cost $200,000 less than we originally anticipated. The money of the $1.3 million, $1.1 million is to reimburse the counties for their election costs, and less than $200,000 was spent for the voters' pamphlet. And if I might just take one moment, at the last emergency board meeting, we talked about finding savings in the voters' pamphlet. And we've made changes in the voters' pamphlet that do save money, not specifically for this special election that I'm here talking to you about getting reimbursed for, but for the February 3rd election. And I'd just be curious whether you have heard from your constituents at all about the change in the voters pamphlet, because we've basically found a way to save money in terms of how much space is taken for measure arguments. And John, you all have copies, I think, but John can certainly show you the difference. And I'm just curious, it's managed to save us money for the February 3rd election, which we'll be back talking to you about later. We've managed to save some money at your behest in terms of the publication of the voters' pamphlet. And I'm curious whether you've heard anything, if you've heard anything. We've heard a couple of comments in the Secretary of State's office about the change, and I'm curious whether other people have heard things.
Haven't heard a thing.
Great. Good news.
I've heard no adverse comment.
I haven't heard a thing.
Well, I could say I've heard no positive comment.
I'm not sure anybody reads it.
No, but Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I would personally comment that I think the change is good. I commend you for finding a way to achieve these savings. It's something that we need to continue to pursue, and I appreciate your efforts on trying to perhaps charge people who get into this voter's pamphlet a more appropriate sum.
Right.
For that privilege, and I hope you continue to pursue that.
I can assure you we will reintroduce into the next session the effort to make the voters' pamphlet pay for itself. Because I agree with you, it makes a lot of sense.
Hopefully it won't get mixed up in other things that they can be in. Yeah, good start. Yeah, Representative Butler.
One quick question. I'm wondering if we've done isolated any of the costs and overhead related to the non-English speaking portion of the pamphlet. How much time, energy, and money are we expending in other languages to get the word out, other than English?
I can get you that specific information, Representative Butler. The amount of funds spent on a Spanish translation, both for the for an online, we do an online version in Spanish, and it's a very small amount in relation to the total voters' pamphlet costs, and I can get you those figures.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I'd like to isolate those costs where that is an issue, as well as any other non-Spanish costs that we have, all non-English, if we could. Thank you.
Anything else? No, Bill, I think you guys are doing a good job trying to get this thing down to something that's affordable. So,
thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just one final comment, Mr. Chair, and that is that we're able to save money on the February voters pamphlet because we're able to condense the arguments. We'll continue to look for other ways to save money, but I can assure you the savings we find in the primary voters pamphlet will be less because we're not able to condense the candidates. I mean, we're not able to put the candidate statements run right after another.
Can have Sam's picture on this page and his summary on this page. I'm going to try and see who complains.
Maybe that'll tell you.
It would really be the luck of the draw.
You know. All right. Adrian, is this our motion down here?
Mr. Chair, it is. The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending that the Emergency Board approve an allocation of $1,287,438 to the Secretary of State from the Special Purpose Appropriation and the Emergency Fund for the payment of those September 16, 2003 special election costs.
Okay, which reflects the reimbursement of expenses incurred. And any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Herb Stuff, 41. Okay. Margaret, Rita, but who all do you have here?
Jerry Reese and Rita Thomason.
Okay.
There are all sorts of people who, if it's possible, would like to speak after.
Okay, well, why don't we let them talk first? That's okay. We sit around and talk. That's our job. So if people have come to talk, bring them up first, and we get with you guys second. Then. Let's do it that way. Sorry.
You technically make a majority of the subcommittee.
Is that okay? Just bring in some testimony. People have come here to testify a little bit. Let's just.
Oh, did it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you want to start with another group?
Yeah, you had some other people that wanted to talk to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you had them come first?
Have them come first.
All right.
I want to get you guys to talk about what we're going to do when we get finished here. Good morning,
Senator Harper. My name is Ken Allen. I'm the director of Oregon AFSCME, Council 75. We represent about 100 bargaining units around the state, have about 21,000 members. We're probably in front of the Employment Relations Board as much as any other union in the state.
Is that a good thing?
There's nothing wrong with that. It means we give them a lot of business.
Good morning. I'm Ed Rutledge. I'm the Labor and Employee Relations Manager for the City of Portland.
Good morning. I'm Susan Skites. I'm a council representative for AFSCME, and I represent the dispatchers, the 911 dispatchers in Portland, as well as various cities in Clackamas County, as well as Clackamas County.
I want to be really clear that while I am at times the sharpest critic of the Employment Relations Board with them, I'm also probably the biggest supporter of the function that they perform. I've been around labor relations in Oregon for about 28 years in the public sector, off and on, and I've seen this agency go from a model 10 to 15 years ago, a model for the whole country in the services that they've been able to perform to an agency now that just barely functions. And it used to be an agency that performed well above the National Labor Relations Board, which handles private sector labor relations, and now has deadlines that are sometimes almost double the amount of time it takes this agency to handle as the National Labor Relations Board. And that used to be how the federal government handled labor relations was an embarrassment. Now they are performing functions almost twice as quickly. So I just want to speak to how that impacts labor relations in the field, both I think for the unions and Mr. Rutledge, I think, will talk about how it impacts employers. When we file a petition to get a new unit, and it what we're seeing are long delays in getting an election, and I'll just give that one example. Between the National Labor Relations Board conducts an election within 42 days, and the Employment Relations Board takes about 77 days to conduct an election. That leads to time of turmoil for the employees and the employer. A simple election ought to get conducted and over with, so we know whether the union is going to represent the employees or not, and so we can get on with that matter. In the field, we also have a situation where we used to have a full staff mediation service with about five mediators. They were able to not only go out and resolve the problematic negotiations where both sides had very contentious problems that needed some help getting resolved, but this agency was able to take a proactive role, and was we were able to use the agency for grievance mediation to resolve, help us resolve grievances between the parties, and the agency was able to go into some of our more problematic situations and provide training in a proactive fashion to get the parties together and to have a better relationship, so over the long haul there wouldn't be problems. We don't have the mediation staff to do that anymore. The only things the mediators are able to respond to are the problems, and oftentimes they go in and just they help get the situation resolved, but it's a band-aid solution, and they're not there now to help provide the long-term relationship building service that they used to provide. The federal mediation service used to use the Oregon mediation service as a role model in how to put these relationships together. And they were very instrumental in us turning around our relationship at Oregon Health Sciences University, where we used to have, we would call it a grievance mill, hundreds and hundreds of grievances, and both the union and management were thoroughly involved with always working on grievances, but weren't able to work on the relationship issue. They helped turn that situation around about 10 years ago for our union and that administration. They have a much better relationship, and I credit a lot to what the mediators were able to provide in training. The same thing has occurred years ago in the city of Portland, where we had lots and lots of grievances and lots of problems, but no proactive training to bring the parties together. And the mediation service helped provide that service years ago. That proactive mediation service is not available any longer. We have contested cases now where the board has to make a decision about who should be in a bargaining unit or if there was an unfair labor practice. The board is actually telling us now that they might conduct hearings by telephone. I don't know how many times you've tried to measure somebody's credibility or the veracity of what they're saying by telephone, but I don't think it's possible to measure somebody's credibility if you're not looking them eyeball to eyeball, hearing what both parties have to say about an issue and then making your determination. If we further cut this agency, they won't be able to go out and hold hearings. There'll be a hearings officer sitting in Salem at a telephone and listening to the parties you know, miles and miles away, given evidence about a case. That's not the way to conduct hearings and make decisions about labor relations. So I'll pass on to the other witnesses unless you have some questions for me, but we're at a critical juncture. If this agency isn't adequately funded, they won't be able to administer and help move forward labor relations in Oregon. They'll be a roadblock to that.
I have to say that it's not often that I agree with these folks. It's my job often to not agree with these folks. We have differences of opinion all the time, but on this particular issue, I am in agreement with them, and probably for some different reasons. By the way, it is It is the character of labor relations that disputes happen. And the city of Portland, and if I may presume other local governments, do have an interest in making sure that there is some measure of alacrity in dispute resolution. It helps us build budgets. It helps us plan service delivery. If disputes linger, it can lead to a bad work environment, and it also makes it very difficult for us to plan and to operate, I think, more efficiently. The other thing that is of concern to me is that as I look at the next couple of bienniums, I think that more and more changes are going to have to occur in the public sector workplace. That's just a fact of life. Another fact of life is that these types of changes are going to cause disputes to happen in the labor and employee relation management relationship. It serves the interests of public employers to have those disputes dealt with as quickly as possible. This request by the ERB board goes directly to the ability of the ERB board to perform a function in dispute resolution. So the City of Portland supports this request by the ERB board simply because it will provide the tools for the ERB board to do its job so that the City of Portland and other local jurisdictions can do theirs in a very tough time right now, in a time of change. So we're hoping that this request by the ERB board will meet support. Thank you.
I have to agree with Ed. It's not very often that I agree with him, but we do work together.
See, aren't meetings great?
Yes.
See?
We work together, and ultimately our goals are the same, and that is to have a productive workplace. And when things get drug out, it simply becomes counteractive. It doesn't happen. I'll give you an example that I'm facing right now. I've been bargaining a contract for CECOM, which is Clackamas County 911, since last year. And even though our timelines are up, it's a strike-barred unit. And we have had one mediation session that was held in December. Best laid plans, the one in January was canceled due to the ice storm. But the next one that we can have is not until February 19th. And the one after that, we've got actually scheduled March 16th for if we need a second or actually a third date. But that is a very long time. That group of people have been at the bargaining table for a year. And the longer that it takes, and we desperately need a mediator. We have worked hard. We cannot resolve these issues ourselves. ERB does provide a very valuable help to both labor and to management. Clackamas County and AFSCME owe ERB a lot. In the beginning of the 90s, they actually came in and did the training for interest-based bargaining. We have used that at every single table at the county for the last 10 years. It has been invaluable, but occasionally we run into roadblocks and we do need a mediator to finish the bargaining.
Let me ask a dumb question since I don't really deal in this area a lot. You in Clackamas County are having a dispute right now. Why don't you and Clackamas County just go work it out? Why do you need the state to get involved in it? Is there something that prohibits you from doing that? Why don't you guys go get your own mediators?
Well, I believe that, first of all, the mediator that we use is Wendy. She has worked with 911 centers before. She mediated Portland 911's.
Is the ERB?
Yes. She's a conciliator now. At the time, she was a mediator. 911 centers are very complicated. They're extremely complicated. And we, right now at the county, we are, each of us are entrenched in our position. I can't get my members to vote for what the county wants, and the county isn't going to give us what we want. And so we need help for someone to find a middle ground. And she's actually been able to begin that process.
But there's nothing that will preclude you from fixing this on your own, is my question, legally.
Trust me, after 29 years and probably 250 sets of negotiations, even though people have a ton of experience, the ability to bring in a mediator is very important.
Yeah, okay. I didn't say it's a smart question.
I'll just give you an example of the cost. The cost that now we're now paying for a consultant to come in and provide some of the proactive mediation can run $1,300, $1,400 a day. And that's a lot of money for the parties. For the city of Portland and our local up there, that might not be quite that much money. But for Malheur County and our local over there, that kind of money is way out of bounds for both of us. And the state has been able to provide those services. The mediators that the state has been able to attract in the past have been pretty experienced, creative bargainers from both sides. And creativity and experience is the key in a mediator, because they're able to come in, look at the situation, evaluate it, come up with a middle ground or a creative idea that the parties may not have thought about. And sometimes it's as much as a face-saving issue, too. A mediator comes in and helps both parties save face.
I don't understand mediation. I was just trying to get it clear in my own mind. Who pays the bill for this mediator between you and Clackamas County? You split the bill. And this is the state mediator, or the herb mediator. Okay, but there's nothing to preclude you from hiring your own if she wasn't available or she was busy or...
The only preclusion is that we have a lot of locals that are very small or remote, a lot of small government jurisdictions, and the cost would be prohibitive for those.
So they don't pay the bill for the mediator if they're small?
The mediation service pays, the Employment Relations Board pays the mediators, and the counties pay a fee. If we file an unfair labor practice charge, then we have to pay a fee on top of that.
That's one of the questions, but we can talk to Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question, and that is that we've got cities and county folks at the table discussing this, and it's my recollection that the freight is basically tacked on to pay for this to based upon the number of state employees we have. Are the folks from local governments, are you interested in having an assessment against local governments? Is that what I'm hearing? In order to pay for this, I just heard you say that that the mediator costs are being split between the county and the association. But I, in order to perpetuate and to keep ERB going, my interest is, I think we're up to $1.63 per employee right now per month.
Clarification, Mr. Chair and Representative Butler. Within the agency's budgets, there's $1.63 budgeted. The current charge remained flat at the previous budget at $1.35.
Okay.
We left that flexibility in case a supplemental request came back.
Okay, but I, now this is in addition to that, and this would be the other local, county, and other agencies that are utilizing these services. Is there any interest in passing on a $1.35 charge, the old charge, in order to continue to have these services as opposed to coming back and dipping into the general fund?
I can't speak for the employers, and I wouldn't presume to, but the union, our union, did not strongly object when you created the fee for filing an unfair labor practice charge. And we're not, the service is of such a value that we're not opposed to paying a reasonable fee. It's just the impact on some of our smaller locals and governments further away is different. So.
Yes, Mr. Chair, what I'm asking is if $1.35 is a reasonable fee to be charging based upon number of state employees, would local agencies and local governments be willing to go ahead and pay that $1.35 as opposed to the $1.68 without increasing it across the board?
Let's bring the next set of people up. Maybe we get sure.
If somebody files a grievance that is deemed to be unreasonable, frivolous, who picks up the cost of that filing? Is it Stillshare?
You mean an unfair labor practice charge?
Uh-huh. Is there ever a situation where the prevailing party would recover its costs?
Yes, we can ask for attorney's fees if same employee of the City of Portland files a frivolous charge without the union's support, or maybe a charge against the city and the union, and we win that, we can ask for attorney's fees.
I'd just like to say City of Portland had the experience this past year, not with this particular labor organization, but we won attorney's fees because the ERB board found that a particular ULP that was filed was basically without merit.
Thank you.
This morning, anybody else wants to come up? Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I do appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly on this, and I know that others appreciate allowing us to have testimony. I won't reiterate what I've presented to you in my written testimony, but I would like to highlight a few things. One of the things that I think that you're probably asking, and I think that we ask, is what impact do these delays have on the employees, employers, and in many cases taxpayers? Because the bottom line is that we are experiencing real life experiences where there are delays in actions that typically have not been occurring. For example, in issues of unit clarifications where they're going to determine whether someone's represented or not, in a recent case the hearings officer put on the record that typically the 30-day period when they have an order, she said quite bluntly on the record that due to my workload, I'm not going to be able to get this out. It ended up being a 60-day period. Fortunately, there was no appeals on that order, which would have even lengthened the process longer. And so I think the question that you need to ask and some of the impacts that they have, even though we're seeing hopefully a rebound in the economy, a reduction in the services provided by ERBs are going to have long-lasting effects. I think my organization, as well as many of the employers that we discussed labor management issues together, believe that ultimately if the parties can't agree on things, that's the best way to do business. I think we have a long proven track record here in Oregon of having that philosophy as far as how to get things done. And certainly there's been plenty of studies, at least for public safety officers, where labor management can work together on issues. There's many studies that show not only do you have decreased deaths and injuries for firefighters in that, you also provide a better public safety to the citizens of Oregon. However, having said that, there are times when issues do arise where the parties can't agree. And in my experience in doing this business and also as a firefighter here in Oregon, ERB has provided huge, immense services to be able to bring the parties together or to resolve these issues. And I think that it speaks for itself that delays in the process not only have an effect on either the employers, whether it's management or whether it's the firefighters or the police officers out providing these services, ultimately these have lasting impacts and arguably to the communities. And so I think that it's important that you take a look at the ramifications of the workload. I do believe that some of the questions you've asked, I think that the members of ERB will be able to ask a lot better and give you a better sense, but I can just say that as someone that represents firefighters and a firefighter myself, we are starting to see the impacts, and we believe that while we think that the message that Oregonians are delivering is that we want government to be efficient and effective, we believe this is a reasonable thing to support, and we think this sends a message not only to the people that are providing the services, but to the citizens of Oregon that this is an important subject. So with that, I would take any questions, or if you would like, Mr. Chair, we could wait, and you could hear from the rest of the panel.
Yeah.
Mr. and Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Boss. I am an assistant attorney general and the attorney in charge of the labor and employment section of the Department of Justice. My section now has seven attorneys and myself, and part of our duties and our legal work is handling appeals of disciplinary action and unfair labor practices that are brought to ERB. State employees who are not represented have a right to file appeals of both disciplinary action and dismissal actions, and that is a large part of our docket. And I'm here to support ALJ Thomas in terms of the technical data that she's provided you on the increase in the number of cases over the past several years. My section has gone from 5 attorneys to 7 attorneys in order to handle that increased workload. We attribute part of this increase in workload to the tightening of state budgets and reorganizations that has occurred as a result of that. Management employees who are laid off have a right to appeal the circumstances of their layoffs to ERB. We've also seen not only more cases, but more complex cases, and has been previously testified when the time between the hearing and the issuance of an order increases, that hurts both parties. It hurts the state agencies because we have to pay more in damages and no one is working for in that position. It hurts the employee because they are hanging out there without a position, not knowing what's going to happen. No one benefits from that situation. As an example of some of the more complex cases that we've brought to ERB, or that have been brought to ERB in the last year, is the litigation that resulted from the dismissal of caseworker arising from the Ashley Pond situation. That case involved a significant number of documents. The press was involved in seeking documents. There were significant privilege issues. And all of those issues have to be brought to the ALJ, who's doing the hearing prior to the hearing, and causes a significant amount of work on ERB. We were recently advised that ERB is no longer providing transcription services. And the result of that is, as you know, you have to have a transcript if you're going to file an appeal or to do a good brief. And basically, that cost will fall on the state agency and or the employee, ultimately, if ERB is not able to transcribe its hearings. Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Mr. and Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, my name is Monica Smith. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. My firm represents public sector labor unions, and I'm here today to support the request of the ERB for the $160,000 in funding. Our firm represents both state and local government employees, teachers, firefighters, corrections officers, a very wide variety of public sector unions. I've been doing this work for approximately 20 years. We have used the services of the ERB for union election cases, for unfair labor practice cases, to mediate grievances, to mediate contract negotiations, and also just as a general source of information about labor law, about the history of collective bargaining in specific units, and various other needs that we have. As I prepared to come speak to you today, it struck me that we just passed the 30th.
Pay for that. Be careful.
I'm sorry. I brought my own. No. We just passed the 30th anniversary of the passage of the PECPA. I don't think there's any celebration or I don't think anyone spent a lot of time noticing it, but it occurred to me that it's worthwhile in your consideration to go back to what the purposes and policies of the PECPA were as initially envisioned in 1973 by the legislature. The purposes and policies have often been consulted by the ERB when in deciding what interpretation of the law is important, and I think that they are useful to consider in making your decision here today. In ORS 243.656, a number of purposes and policies are noted. For example, that the people of Oregon have a fundamental interest in the development of harmonious and cooperative relationships between the government and its employees, that disputes between public employers and employees are injurious to the public as well as to the employers and employees, and that collective bargaining and union representation can, quote, alleviate various forms of strife and unrest, quote, thereby protecting the public from interruptions of necessary services. Based on these policies, the legislature stated that it was the purpose of the PECPA to obligate public employers, public employees, and their representatives to enter into collective negotiations with willingness to resolve employment-related disputes to sign collective bargaining agreements. Now, as the committee members know, these policies and purposes are not self-enforcing, nor are they easy to carry out, even for the best-intentioned employers, unions, or employees. Disputes inevitably occur. The Employment Relations Board, as the state agency charged with interpreting and enforcing the PECPA, plays a crucial role in ensuring that the rights and obligations set out in the PECPA have meaning, and that the public, as well as the employers and employees, receives the benefits that the legislature envisioned. I think all of us appearing before you today would agree that the PECPA works and that those policies are still true and important, that collective bargaining really does alleviate strife and unrest and really does result in better service to the public. I know that you've heard from a variety of people, and we'll hear from more, and I would just like to highlight a couple of things that I think are most important for you to consider. As various people have said, unresolved disputes really do cost money. We all understand that it's a bad time in the budget and it's hard for you to allocate more money, but I think by not allocating the money requested by ERB, you really are costing money both to the state and to local government agencies. Sometimes the savings are dollar amounts that are very measurable. For example, back pay is often awarded in an unfair labor practice case. Obviously, the longer the delay in the process, the more that back pay accumulates, interest can be awarded, and the liability increases on the employer with every delay in the process. As business people, you know that one of the most important aspects of running an effective and efficient business is to know your liabilities, to be able to plan for your liabilities. And when the ERB is understaffed, no one can either ascertain or plan for the liability that results in an unfair labor practice case. Some savings, though, are also immeasurable, and that is, I think all of us know the effect of an unresolved dispute on the workplace. It is simply impossible for employees to concentrate and for the business of government to run effectively when there is a pending unfair labor practice charge, when there are unresolved grievances, or when there's an unresolved issue about whether employees have union representation and what union will represent them. No one can tell you what that dollar amount is, but I think every labor relations person will agree that the disruption does cost money. Secondly, I think that causing ERB to work without the necessary resources also costs money. For example, this issue of transcripts. If you have someone to transcribe hearings so that the ALJ and the board members can read the transcript, that's an essential part of their decision-making process. Consider what the alternative is. If you have no written transcript, the four decision makers, that is the ALJ and the three board members, have to consult tapes to find out what witnesses said and what evidence is in the record. That means four different people have to plow through tapes to find out what testimony is there and what what evidence there is to support a decision one way or the other. It's a terribly inefficient process that can be eliminated and streamlined if you allocate the money that's requested. I think the lack of a transcript also ends up in a more questionable result and may cause more appeals than having the transcription available at the time the decision is made. And finally, I want to support the statement of the ERB and also Ms. Boss that cases have become more complicated, more complex. As I said, I've been doing this 20 years and feel like I should know the answer to many questions these days, but I find that every day the issues that come before me are harder to understand, harder to discern. I think it's a result partly of in bad economic times, people become more creative. Both labor and management might try theories for saving money that have not been tried before. There are many untested issues that need to come before the ERB to be resolved. A more complex case is more work for the ALJ, which means that the increase in caseload is quite significant, and there is not the time available to give the cases the attention that they deserve. In closing, I want to say that support for the Employment Relations Board is an issue on which both labor and management can unite. Having an adequate budget for the agency that enforces the law is to the benefit of both employers and unions and to the public in general. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Why don't we have any questions? Why don't we have Margaret, Rita, Gary, the original group back up. Maybe before we get started, Gary, it might be helpful to me anyway. This is Representative Butler's committee during the session. Just give a brief synopsis of what you guys looked at, what you're looking for through the interim, just kind of where you wanted this thing to head, Tom.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be delighted to just give a brief synopsis from my recollection and the notes that I had. The Ways and Means General Government Committee found that Employee Relations Board services were indeed valuable to both labor and management, and that the general fund portion of the budget for the ERB had been declining, while the monthly employee assessments against state agency employees was in fact increasing. And I believe that Monica has indicated that we did approve an assessment rate at a higher level by, I think it was 28 cents from 135 to 168, whatever that is, to increase that to be able to come up with a continuing budget. But the concern was that the core mission of the ERB continued to expand. There was also a concern that there was no real definite arrangement for fee-for-services for the local bargaining units to come in. And so what we did was we basically gave them an assignment to go back to work to define where their cost centers were, as well as any of the potential fee-for-services resources. And again, we did indicate to them and told them, as indicated in our printup here today, that we encouraged them to return with the request if they were experiencing seriously expanding and complex caseloads, and that was an issue that we weren't comfortable with, that perhaps the caseloads themselves, even though there's an indication that the numbers may be down, the complexity of those caseloads would be going up, with the idea that perhaps there could be an addition of employees if the complexity of the cases were in fact expanding. So that's and Monica could give you any further feeling in that regard, but there was and I think we heard it today, that there was some concern about the expansion of the core mission and how local governments and other bargaining units fit into that that overall expanded cost base and where we were going to be able to basically fill back in, whether local governments wanted to participate by a fee for service or whether local governments wanted to assess themselves. When I talk about local governments, I'm also talking about schools. There's a lot of these issues that deal with our schools and other bargaining units in that regard, but also the cities and the counties and irrigation districts as well have all experienced a greater complexity of cases. So with that, we encourage them to do the best they could without dipping into the general fund and to return to us if the complexity of the cases, and again, they were to study any of the other fee-for-services that might be available in order, and I would like to know if we've collected those fee-for-services, and Monica may have that, and certainly Satish would probably have some of that information, as to what kinds of assessments for the fee-for-services for those expanding complexity of cases may be. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. So when the session ended, you guys set off to try and gather some information, try and get some answers to this, try and figure out where we're going. Is that correct? We have kind of a work group, Rita?
We have a work group, and I've been collecting data from other states. We saw that as a budget note for the 2005-2007.
Yeah, to get ourselves ready.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Co-chairs Dukes and Harper and members of the committee, I'm Gary Weeks. I'm the director of the Department of Administrative Services. I don't come up with agencies very often. I do in this case because my role is being responsible for the labor relations of this that the state government. Makes it very important to me that we have an effective employment relations board, one that works well, and I have to make the same declaration a number of other people have, and that is I don't always agree with the decisions of the employment relations board, nor do I agree with the position of the union on occasion, but we work things out. We have to in order to keep our business going. I think that as I looked back, and I didn't have the opportunity to sit in on Representative Butler's committee, but I have over the last few days read much of the testimony, read the Legislative Fiscal Office report and a number of other materials that relate to those conversations. And it seems to me that there's a lot of good conversation and a lot of good discussion around two basic areas, really. One was, who does the board serve? You know, is it largely an organization that serves the needs of the unions and the local government, or is it a contributor to the success of state government and its labor relations? And what I read is a lot of difference of opinion about that, and much of it based on caseload that also has differences of opinion. There were numbers presented during the session, and I think even subsequent, that caused people to have different feelings about what's the real work of the board historically and on into this current biennium. And it seems to me that it's clear that there is an increasing amount of work on the part of state government, and that, as someone has said, I think Representative Butler, those cases are more complex, those cases are taking more time, and this is not just a agency that serves the needs of county and city government and their labor relations, but it's an agency that has a lot to do with the way state government relates to its workforce and its labor issues. So, you know, as I take sort of be able to step back and take a look at those issues and all the conversation, I'm not sure that we move this forward by simply deferring it, you know, to some point down the road. And I'd like to have you consider the option of giving this agency a limited duration authority for 6 months till the June e-board, letting them actually work the caseload that we know is in place. There's no question that there's caseload there waiting to be worked, but letting them work the caseload that is in place. And during that 6 months, giving us an opportunity to put an independent view in the agency about what is the caseload, who should be charged for it, how much work is done for local government and state government. And I'd offer to you that I have independent auditors that I think I can release to actually go in and do an independent audit, sort of internal audit view of this, and bring you back something in 6 months. But during that period of time, if you would be willing to permit a limited duration positions, well, the funding is present. We can keep the workload going. We don't fall farther behind, but we can bring you some real data that's of an independent nature about the circumstances of the board. And I'd ask you to consider that as an alternative to simply deferring this issue and letting us fall what I believe to be farther behind in some important work that the board has to do. So that's my plea today, I guess, and the consideration that I ask you to give to the board in this request.
How could, you know, Gary, I appreciate that, but you know, one of the things I'm struggling with is the incomplete data sets that we have. The data that we do have doesn't indicate that the problem is that we're falling over the cliff.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to let Rita answer that more effectively than I will, but I think there is not falling. I'm not so worried about falling over the cliff as I am about us being able to timely consider the labor and management requests that are coming before the board. And I, one of the things that I'm not sure the legislative committee was able to consider is that we now have 13,000 employees that are home health care workers that under PECPA are potential clients for this board. We have a labor contract with them, and whether we would assign the labor contract or not with the home health care workers, they still were an organized union, and under PECPA had the rights to ERB. So from just that perspective alone, the potential workload of this group is dramatically increased. Now, I don't know how much will come to them as a result of the home health care workers, but I do know there's work that's not being done in a timely basis today. I know there's potential future work, and I know there's a question about who should be paying for this, locals, the union, and the state. And those are all things that I'd like to be able to have resolved over the next 6 months for your benefit and for our benefit. But I just struggle with us not doing anything over that 6 months that addresses the current situation.
We left at the end of August with these questions out there, cost allocation. Why aren't the questions answered today? We had 6 months to work on this. Okay, Rita. Me.
Chair Harper. Chair Dukes, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to finally get in front of you and speak about this agency. I've only been the chair of this board since June when Dave Steitler stepped down. But I have managed several budgets inside state government, including the Labor Relations Division. I was chief negotiator for the state of Oregon, and I was Senate Labor Committee counsel in the 95 session when we rewrote the Collective Bargaining Act. As you will recall, and I'm going to get to the performance measures because I think it's a critical discussion for your decision today. But as you will remember in the 95 session when we worked Senate Bill 750, the purpose of that law was to help managers manage their budgets. And I think given what is happening at the ERB board right now, we are failing the state, and it is going to continue to fail the state in a more dramatic way as the months proceed. So it just sort of that as a foundation. I want to raise one issue that did not appear in any of the information that I know that was forwarded to you that has been bothering me on a monthly basis. We lost an ALJ in this agency in July because of a layoff. We lost one actual body. Our withdrawal rate by our highly experienced administrative law judges has been about 60 cases a year. When we lost that position, we dropped from a withdrawal rate of approximately 30 cases for every 6 months to six. Each case that is not withdrawn at a contested case hearing for 1.2 days costs the state about $13,000 a day. And so in the information that I gave to the LFO and to DAS, and I noticed that Satish did put in his recommendation, that the cost to laying off this administrative law judge for a six-month period has cost the state about $290,000. And I think that's actually a low estimate. I'm basing the $13,000 on information that this agency gave to the legislature in 2001 based on settlement case withdrawals. Over a one-year period, it'll be close to $600,000 that we will be facing by the end of June. We have two administrative law judges who are highly trained, very active. They simply do not have time to do the settlement work the three judges do, which this is why we added a third judge in 1999, because we realized we couldn't case manage these cases in a way that helped employers contain their costs. So as leading the agency and as a taxpayer, I'm very troubled as I see this withdrawal rate just not actively working any longer. We have recently had an administrative law judge retire, and we were able to rehire the one that we laid off in July. That administrative law judge walked into a case process that has 13 hearings scheduled by the end of March. What that means to the state of Oregon is that while he's managing these cases, he's having actual hearings for a month, an extraordinary rate for an administrative law judge. It means that all of the cases that I assign to him each week will be put further and further behind. And just to personalize this a little bit, I didn't have time to look at Eastern Oregon, but I did check our caseload for the Coos County area. We've had 18 cases since 1989 come out of Coos County area. We have an extremely active dispute going on at the county level right now that has a potential for a big blow-up. Klamath Falls.
Especially harassment case you're talking about?
It was not that case.
Yeah. But no, not that one.
Klamath Falls, we've had 9 cases since 1989, several of them very large cases. And I agree with Monica Smith, and I think you all know this if you run a business. If you've got problems in your workplace, you're losing money. And the further and further that we place out the scheduling of these hearings, which is not a performance measure, and now I would like to get to the performance measure issue. And I have discussed this with Monica. I have worked for the Senate. I've worked for this legislature, and I have managed a budget. And I think we do a disservice to you to just give you numbers and not explain to you what these mean to the state. That will never happen when I'm chair of this board. You'll get the raw numbers, and I will explain to you what that means. I shared with Monica that while it appears that perhaps the state assessment has been creeping up, and it has been creeping up over the last few years, we've lost $1 million in local funding dollars, what has not been explained is the weight value to state cases. And, for instance, when one of our mediators mediates the SEIU bargaining unit, there are 22,000 members in that bargaining unit. When I was chief negotiator for the state, the cost to that settlement for that bargaining unit was $75 million in 1993. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's important, as I would, I worked for Inland Steel in Chicago for a period of time. When I went to my boss, I weight valued my contracts for Inland Steel. And I think that if you run a business, you would weight value what this agency does for this state. We can't compare what our mediator does if they spend 14 hours with 6 people in Kaiser. That's 14 hours, but it's not a good weight value added for you to figure out what has happened to state budgets when they only spend 3 with the SEIU contract. In many cases, in all cases, I will say this, all state agency negotiators are highly trained. They've been trained by our mediation staff. Most of the unions have been trained by our mediation staff. Our mediators may spend fewer hours on the 22,000 employees collective bargaining agreement, but they are at the end of the phone line, and when there's a strike, as there was in 1995, it's our mediators who are helping bring resolution to an extremely costly government contract. So I've asked Monica, and she apparently did not agree with me, but I think it's the agency's job to explain weight values of what this agency does. I don't think the raw data of our performance measures does that. I think they are the right performance measures, but I think it's our job and the LFO's job to explain to this board or this commission, I'm sorry, this committee, what they mean to the state. And so I would ask you to consider that, and in particular consider that every day that we do not employ an administrative law judge, we don't have case withdrawals or case settlements going on. I think Margaret has described it that way. It is costing this state money. And I want to say a couple things about back pay awards. We have never prioritized cases according to state or local governments. It is the state law here that the PECPA covers all public employers. Last year we had 45 petitions come in from local governments to get new bargaining units. Sometime in the past 10 years, and I don't understand what happened, there has been a dispute that seems to have arisen about whether or not places like, and I use the city of Vail as an example, should pay their full share of a case that comes to the Employment Relations Board. If you followed what's happened in Vail, they closed their police department last year. an unfair labor practice was filed, they each party paid $250. That's the fee that was set in 95 by the legislature. And we proceeded to hearing, and they were found guilty of an unfair labor practice. The back pay award there is over in excess of $200,000. If we had had to assess a little town like Vail, which is struggling with this back pay award, also some sort of hourly rate, it would have simply shut the city down. And I think that wisely, when our act was formed, it was decided by the legislature to spread the cost. The city of Portland could probably pay the herb board an hourly rate. Cities like Vail cannot. I would say small towns in Coos County and Klamath Falls simply could not. They will have labor disputes, but they'll do the best they can to try and get their folks back in from strikes. I had one little paragraph. I've saved you from listening to my whole speech, which I just thought was brilliant. But I do want to say this because Senator Winter said this last year during the committee. She said, please don't be, penny wise and a pound foolish. And this is what I say. The work done by this board is calculated not by what does happen, but what does not happen. When we resolve a dispute prior to a hearing, the public in this state saves approximately $13,000. When we're able to quickly hear and resolve contested cases, the public saves both back pay awards, but it also saves the work climate and the lack of employee productivity. When the board helps resolve a heated labor dispute short of a strike, the employer does not bear the cost of a strike such as OHSU 2 years ago and does not have to spend years to reestablish an efficient and effective workforce. I was hired from Michigan in 92 to come out and help DAS manage their labor relations with the state of Oregon. I come from a state where collective bargaining does not allow strikes. However, I was involved in managing about 25 strikes for employers in Michigan because there the collective bargaining law, although it doesn't provide for strikes, unions have struck approximately 400 times during the period of that law. We have had something like 11 or 12, and Wendy Greenwell can probably tell me the exact number, strikes in this state over the entire 30 years of this agency. And I think it's a credit to the work that's been done by the agency, and hopefully we can continue to do to keep things from this happening. I'm asking you to help me run the agency. I'd be happy to continue to collect data and speak to everyone in the world about what the agency does, but as I said to Monica when she asked me for more data a couple of weeks ago, I said, we have lost our data person, we have lost our computer processing research person, we simply have no one else except me to do this, and I'm the chief judge of this board, and either I work full-time collecting data to show that what we do is of value here, or I just try to continue to work as chief judge and get cases out. And I'm really at that critical point of saying, what's the most important thing for me to do for the state and for my job? So I'm just asking for help to release the assessment that was already added to other state agencies. I think it was a fair assessment in the past when we followed our statutory mandate, which requires us to give you a number for that assessment. It sometimes has gone down when we felt that the state cases didn't warrant it. Right now, and I shared with Monica, I believe with a weighted value that our state cases are costing the agency about two-thirds of our time, two-thirds of our work. The value is that. So I don't want to get caught up in whether we have 20% of state cases or 23%. We know for a fact that all state cases average about one full day more per hearing than any of the local government cases. They're more complex. The back pay liability is far more significant. I think those need to be weight valued and understood before we make decisions about whether just how many cases did we handle for state and local governments. I'm asking you to help us manage this state law. Frankly, if I get an opportunity to come back to you next year, I'd like to tell you a fuller picture of how I think that this agency saves this state a lot of money and to partner with you in making that continue to happen. Thank you.
Cost allocation, one of the questions, there was an interim budget note that put together an interim work group. Do you guys have that report for us?
We don't have a work group report yet because that's for the next budget, but we're working on it.
All right, so that's still work in progress.
It is.
So we still don't have a feel for how we should cost allocate.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think maybe some of Rita's remarks may argue in support of what I'm suggesting you consider, and that is to let us move forward with a workload, but to have some sort of resource that we apply within the agency so that we can actually get these numbers done and get it back to you, not next biennium, but you know, within the next few months and stuff, so you really have a clear picture of what's going on, because I think she's correct. It's difficult for the judges and the referees and others to do this kind of work. I've got some resource. I'm willing to put it to there.
I mean, Gary, we got 47,000 full-time employees. We ought to be able to spring a few folks
Mr. Chairman,
help
I'm
with
saying
these overworked people that have important jobs to do.
And Mr. Chairman, and Madam Co-Chair, I'm sorry we didn't take this on sooner. I didn't realize that the agency was struggling this much to get the data put together for you, but we know it now, and we can get it to you.
The performance measures. We have a performance standard, average number of days from start to finish, agency. We have a goal of 300 days, which is your goal. Right now we're at 107.
Well, it would help if this wasn't upside down. I could find my performance measures.
Start to worry about them when they read stuff. Well,
I mean, is that it's rare?
Yeah, I got it. I'm sorry. I got my stuff.
That's the current assessment of the state, or are those bogus numbers? Or
no. That particular
as a snapshot as of as we speak.
But this is where I think, Senator Harper, this is where I think my job comes in to explain that number to you. And if it hasn't been explained in the past, I apologize for that. But please, you know, I'll try to do my best. I emailed Monica and tried to give her a larger projected value on the 107 because that's for 2003 cases.
We think that's going up because we think the cases are complex.
Significantly. And yeah. I gave her a formula for how I figured out that that case, I think by July, will be somewhere around 420 some. I figure about 420 days. And I think it's a valid formula. I mean, things could happen in between, but I haven't seen anything that's happened in the last 2 months that's going to make that change. And that is based on how many outstanding 2003 cases we have, which is about 65 cases right now.
Okay, so it's a work in progress.
That particular performance measure is always a delayed number for the legislature.
And also, the question that I personally had was, these performance measures, they're Oregon's, I understand that. Does every state has an ERB or some semblance thereof?
33 states have.
33 states. You know, what are their performance standards and how are they doing? You know, are we lousy? Are we great? Are we somewhere in the middle? I mean, just get a feel. Not that we necessarily are going to use any of those guys, but just have a feel for what's going on.
Senator, as soon as I heard last week from Margaret Halleck that you were interested in that information, I did send out an email to the head of our state association asking if there had been any study. I asked him about 5 questions, and there has not been a study. I got a little information back from several states, but not enough because I didn't know that we were going to have that question asked about what other states are doing. I think easily by next session we'll know what other states are doing because they're now trying to collect the data so we get some sort of a report.
Next session?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you can get to Baghdad in 21 days. Why is it going to take us?
Mr. Chairman, I think with the right resource, if we can put Rita and her agency, it won't take till next session to get an understanding of what the performance measures are in other states. So.
Mr. Weeks, you suggested limited duration people. You're not talking 6 months, are you? Limited duration.
Madam Co-Chair, I'm talking about the DAS has the authority to put positions on limited duration. There is an expenditure limitation that you have to approve, but the revenue's there. And I'm talking about having some people put on ALJ and a support person put on that limited duration until the June emergency board meeting, where I think we can bring you back some real clear information that will help answer some of the questions that are unanswered today, and will give you a level of comfort to either go ahead with those positions for the balance of the biennium or to say no more.
So you are suggesting that in 6 months those positions could go away.
I'm giving you what I think is the e-board responsibility have to review this after we get the information. It seems a lot to wait 18 more months before we give you the information. I would have a chance to have a difficult time buying that myself.
Mr. Chair, from time to time we come across an agency that just somehow was out of the radar screen, I guess. We out of theirs and they out of ours. And I appreciate all of the work that Representative Butler has done, and it sounds as though the subcommittee tried to get the point across last session, and perhaps that didn't happen as well as it could have. But I have noticed over time that when the DAS gets involved and they get the understanding that things could come to a screeching halt about something they care about, that we get results. I think that the underlying issues of who pays for what are not something that we can do anything about in the interim. That's a session issue, and that we probably ought to continue the work that they're doing, but keep them under the gun, and Mr. Weeks' suggestion would do that. So I guess I'm advocating for what he is suggesting and saying. If they don't come up with the good results in 6 months, and then we haven't resolved things by the time next session comes, they ought to be prepared for the fact that there could be some huge changes to their agency, and they might not be changes that they'd necessarily prefer. But I think in them we tell the subcommittee to go and do what you think is right, because you've tried everything else.
Thank you, Senator Dukes. I'm almost there with you. Before I forget, ONA is in support of Herb. Thank you, Brian. We don't let Brian talk if we can help it. I'm still not comfortable. We have enough data to make good decisions. How about 90 days? Can we March? When do we come back?
April, Mr. Chairman, I believe.
Because you guys...
March is a little...
No, I don't. I disagree. I think you can get together a pretty good idea of the cost allocation, where we need to go in cost allocation. A pretty good idea. You'll have 90 more days of data on where these cases are, correct? And you'll have 3 months for the smart people to get together national standards, make sure that we are somewhat consistent or inconsistent. We elect to do that. And we're not making a decision on this, but the Measure 30 uncertainty is out there. I mean, that's just a fact of life. But if we gave these guys 30, and I'm real comfortable making a decision, there's plenty of ways to skin the cat.
Chair, isn't there another 17 states that have no ERVs? It'd be interesting to know what they do as well.
The other thing, and this probably won't get 90 days, but, why do we need an ERV at all? Is there a better mousetrap out there? I don't expect you guys to bring that forward, but there's 17 other ways to do it. I don't know whether it's smart or dumb.
Mr. Chairman, I think we could do a good analysis of what other states are doing, both those that have something similar to ERB and those that don't. I mean, likelihood is those that don't have bargaining agreements like we do and don't have unions like we do, and so it's not a worry for them. But we can do that kind of analysis. My only reservation about the 90 days as compared to coming in April rather than June is that Rita has to hire somebody. There's no one on board right now because she has no authority to hire the ALJ. So hiring another ALJ and beginning to work on that caseload is something that she's going to have to get done if you agree to let her continue. If it must be 90 days, we will in 90 days bring you back something that discusses the caseload and tries to forecast the impact of Rita hiring another ALJ. I think the data would be better in 6 months than it would be in 3 months, but we can certainly do that, Mr. Chairman, if that's your goal. So.
There's a couple other bullets that Monica came up with last night after our discussion. Are there technology improvements that we can make to facilitate?
Mr. Chairman, that would be one of the things the internal audit would look at.
Are there best practices that we could, there's stuff we can get on the phone and find these things out fairly quick? That's back to Tom's question. Are there better mousetraps out there?
Mr. Chair,
how could you better measure the status of outstanding cases?
I think that we need all of that, and 90 days is a very short period of time. But I'm particularly interested that we give them the help that they need to free them up to be able to do that, because otherwise Gary's shop's doing it all, and they've not been running the agency. I think it's critical that someone in the agency be able to help pull all of this together with the assistance of DAS, knowing where to look and what questions to ask. If we're going to make these kinds of decisions, it's important that we have the information we need. And, mm-hmm. and I don't see going to June as being a really long period of time.
Tom? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm anxious as well about if and I have confidence that Judge Thomas is, in fact, gathering information as best she can. And there perhaps is a need for an office specialist, but I also know that, as you've indicated, Mr. Chair, there probably is someone that could help them out from some of the agencies. But a lot of the testimony this morning has been around the issue of mediation and those kinds of things, going out and holding hearings, unresolved issues that mediators have been taking care of, and yet the request is for an administrative law judge. I'm wondering if you know the issues maybe we're asking for something that we really don't need at that point. I don't know how it's being structured within the agency, but those are certainly important issues, and if we had someone from DAS that was able to accumulate the information, that would certainly relieve Judge Thomas of having to do the ministerial kinds of issues.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think the kind of analysis I'm thinking of working with Rita and her staff would answer the question that Representative Butler's asking, and that is, you know, what sorts of folks do we actually need in the agency? What are the skills that are required in the agency to get the job done? And we would certainly look at the kinds of things that your staff has suggested in terms of technology, workflow, how they prioritize their activities and so on. Those would all be an automatic part of it. And I think in 6 months we could develop some good ideas for it. The other reason I think this is timely to do this in 6 months is that we can develop some suggestions for you around how this ought to be financed, the whole operation ought to be financed, and give those to you in time for you to give some feedback to the agency before their budget goes in. So the budget is due September 1. The agency, if we worked on this for 6 months, would be able to maybe use the information we have in preparation for their budget. Now, obviously, it wouldn't be a full legislative direction, but it would be some direction from you about things like financing and so on like that. And I think we can come up with some suggestions for you in that regard in 6 months that would, you know, that would make some sense.
So restate your deal, Gary. What's your deal?
Mr. Chairman, my suggestion to you is that you permit the agency to hire through June limited duration positions, one ALJ, one half-time support person. In that period of time, we will, through our DAS internal audit staff, and I'll break the news to them later today about this, but we will commit to having someone work within the agency to develop the kind of data that I think you're asking for, to examine the workflow in the agency, and to bring you some suggestions on future ways that this agency's work might be financed. And I think we can do that in 6 months and do a good job in 6 months.
Representative Miller.
Your original suggestion, the 3 months, 90 days, I'm wondering whether or not, as we wrestle somewhat between 180 and 90, is 90 preferable to zero?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, I think it is. I mean, from my viewpoint as the responsible for state labor, the labor issues, I want ERB not to fall behind And if that means I can only get 90 days, certainly.
With that in mind, if you have the authority for 90 days, and it's likely that our next meeting is probably prior to 90 days, could you report on the progress? And if we thought it was satisfactory, we would continue that authority for another 3 months or the rest of the biennium.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, if that's the feeling of the subcommittee, yes. I mean, we in 90 days we'll obviously have some good work done, and we can report on that. I think, in fairness to Rita, though, she won't be able to have a full 90-day impact of another 1.5 FTE because she's got to go out and hire somebody and get them on board and so on. That was my only reason for pushing on 180 rather than 90, but. We can deliver something and have another conversation about should this continue 90 more days
or longer.
I mean, I think for us to do the research nationally and really bring back a good financing model in a comparison with other agencies, we might not have all that done in the next 3 months. But
what could you get done in 90 days? I mean, could you get them hired?
Senator Harper, we can probably hire temporary employees. We would not be able to go through the DAS hiring process, and
But in this case, with a limited duration, these are temporary employees anyway. So we could, that would be pretty.
Are these your smoke and mirror employees, or are these ours? What are you talking about here?
Mr. Chairman.
Your suggestion was your smoke and mirror employees.
No, Mr. Chairman. I wouldn't suggest that to you. The employees are limited duration employees employed by the agency. I have the internal auditors, which we would assign to the agency.
No, you were just going to provide help.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chair. If they're asking them to come and report to an emergency board, the next emergency board is in 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so it's either 2 months or 4 months or 6 months.
Yeah. See, I think you can gather this stuff in a couple of weeks, but what do I know? I don't work in the government. What happens in June if your case falls apart? Are you guys going to bow out gracefully, or are you going to fight this thing?
Senator Harper, I assure you that this case will not fall apart.
I know the answer to that.
I've only had time to really just give you a brief synopsis of, I think, what is going on in terms of the numbers for this agency, and I appreciate the time to do that.
6 month limited duration.
Mr. Chair, there was one statistic that I may not have really grasped, and that was that when we dropped the ALJ in July of 2003, that layoff, the cases went from 30 cases to 6 cases?
Our average withdrawal rate or settlement rate by our administrative law judges has been consistently about 60 cases a year. They're able to, and that's not something the mediator does. These are judges who are lawyers that do that in the midst of a case, as any judge would on a bench. But because they don't have time to work the cases now, they're not getting settlements. They're just scheduling them for hearing. They're not able to spend the time with the parties working out the details of settlements.
It just sounds an awful lot like the way I do dishes. You just accumulate them, unfortunately, without getting it resolved. I guess if we terminated a very, very effective ALJ, and my recollection was, When we reviewed this with Mr. Steidler during the regular session, that your office specialist was full-time, but was very, very effective. Yeah, very effective. And
yes.
It looks like to me that we're looking for an administrative law judge when we really need a full-time administrative law judge, when we really need a very effective full-time office specialist, although it be temporary limited duration.
Representative Butler, maybe I can explain to you. Our office specialist was promoted to our office executive assistant. The statute requires a board secretary, and she continues to be extraordinarily efficient. One of the budget notes that the committee asked us to do was to have DAS review all of our positions, and that was submitted to DAS in October, and they're attempting to figure out what to do with our four remaining office staff positions. We have four ladies over 50 who, I think, when we got a call back from DAS, they said, these positions don't fit into any job descriptions, and my response was, of course they don't, because all of these ladies are doing three jobs, and they've done it with no additional pay. So this lady was promoted, but we could use that position that she left needs to be filled. It was a pivotal position for doing things like docketing, picking up transcription. That position is just empty now.
Mr. Chairman, if it would give the committee more comfort on a six-month program, we'd be happy to report at the next e-board on our progress and let you know how, you know, what we've done to date and where we're heading and what we found and so on, if that would give the committee more,
yeah,
more comfort.
You're talking about both billets or just the law judge? What's
both
your
positions are critical, Senator, to the agency.
Funded by assessments or...
Which you've already approved. I mean, Mr. Chairman, the revenue is in place. We're talking about expenditure authority only.
How much would that be for 6 months? Did you run that?
Part of it instead of
yeah, it'd be partial. So a couple of pennies instead of the full 20 cents or whatever it was.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, within state agency budgets, those budgets still contain the higher $1.63 per month per FTE. They're currently being charged $135, and that's what the agency's budget was built on. So there's that flexibility that agencies won't need more limitation or more authority. It's already there for them. I guess a clarifying question that I would have based on, I think, the motion that I'm hearing is both positions for 6 months, which would put them to July, but the agency would be reporting back to the emergency board in June. Then I guess the funding decision is, should it be through assessment or general fund? If assessment, is there not adequate ending balance such that the assessment to agencies would not need to be raised at this point and maybe wait until July? Because I think we're looking at, if the rough calculations come out correctly, we're looking at about $53,000, $54,000 to fund that 16 or 6 months.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services.
You thought you weren't going to get the phone.
There may be an issue with the agency being able to pay for these positions for 6 months without the increase in assessments. There's a chance that they may be, but we don't have an answer.
When will you have the answer?
We can have
6 months.
I mean, June, decision time in June. We'll plan on assessment, but if you wind up with an email, is that what you're saying?
Sure. Yes. Mr. Chair, we can report to you in April if the agency needs to have its assessments increased.
Mr. Chair and members, it appeared, I think, the last numbers that the estimated ending balance was around $200,000 for the assessment program. So I guess that's the question. Are they comfortable with not increasing the assessment to agencies at that point, getting the additional expenditure limitation, and using ending balance pending the report back in June?
Mr. Chair, if that might be a way to go, is not increase the assessment, but we make a report in April, and if needed, then ask for the increase in assessment.
All right, we're prepared to pay for this, but you guys figured out how to do this.
May I ask Senator Harper,
you want to be clear on something?
I would like just some clarity.
You don't have the big picture.
As I go back to report to our board secretary, who's will tell me we have no money left in our ending balance because now we do everything quarterly. I want to make sure I understand this. If the assessment isn't released to us from state agencies, and we run out of money, are we going to have to increase the assessment from 163 to, say, 184 for the remaining months of the biennium to make up for the money that perhaps we spent that we shouldn't have went? You understand what I'm asking right now?
That's not the way I read it. But
I just don't want to have to try and get into that conversation if it just makes more sense just to release it for a period of time.
Why don't you guys figure it out? Is there you need any help from us? Or we just confuse you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if this subcommittee and the full e-board approve additional expenditure limitation, I believe it is within the authority of DAS to administratively raise that charge. I guess the understanding, I believe, would be of the subcommittee is that it would not go beyond the 163, and it would only be okay. raised to the point that is needed to cover the expenditure limitation that's approved.
Yeah, right.
And that we would, I mean, what I understand is that we would use ending balance first.
And if then, there is.
And we would, in April, be able to tell you how much of the ending balance we used and then how much the assessment would have to be increased.
From 135 to
whatever the number might be.
All right. Is that clear?
Well, for a non-budget person, it's reasonably clear. Thank you.
Matt. I'm going to restate it for the record.
Now, what? I want to know what I'm going to be chairing in June. What am I going to get back from you guys? What am I going to see?
Mr. Chairman, in June, you're going to see an analysis of the caseload, both the local caseload and the state caseload. So you'll be able to know, you know, where the work is being done.
By hours or?
By cases, and I don't know by
where
hours.
Work. Work.
That's I think, not an analysis is the correct word, because yeah. I think it's fair for you to understand the weighted value of our cases. Instead
okay,
of
weighted value.
Yeah.
So we'll show you that in June. We will provide you with information about what other states are doing and their fee schedules, both states that have ERB, well, and then which states don't have ERB, and how they're how they're dealing with the issue.
What their performance standards
right.
are.
We will suggest to you some options in June about how you might want to, in the future, consider financing this agency. I mean, it could be assessment. It could continue to be one of those options, but there could be some local government charge or something like that. And I think Co-Chair Dukes is right that you don't have the authority to change that as an e-board, but it could be what we build into the budget with some direction from you, some concurrence from you. So we'll do our best to show you some options for how you might finance this agency in the future, given the caseload spread among local and state. And so there should be some elasticity in there so that the formula isn't set so that it depends on 50% being state, 50% being local, so that if the caseload changes, the way you finance is elastic, so it changes with the change in the caseload. We ought to be looking at that, looking at it from that perspective.
Are you going to give Monica some interim how am I doing reports?
Mr. Chairman, we would also request to be on the agenda for April to let you know where we are, and okay. if your staff would like more updates than before April, we try to figure a schedule to do that too.
And what is going to be our decision process in June to figure out whether you smoked us or not?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in June, if we don't bring a case forward that demonstrates that there's a caseload requiring the 1.5 FTE that you're approving on a limited duration today, if we don't bring the caseload forward that demonstrates that that's needed, then we would assume that you would withdraw the authority for that 1.5 positions, and because they're limited duration, they would be let go.
Will we use your performance standards as a measurement, or what would be the analysis?
But along with the analysis, I think that, Mr. Chair, I think that our performance standards are adequate. I think the numbers are correct. And we'll be adding a performance standard related to case settlements, because when I became chair, I realized that this is a significant cost value for the state. And we just haven't done that as a performance measure, but we will be measuring that.
You're not going to bring me testimony saying I need these people because I really need them.
No, Mr. Chairman, if the data is not there to support it, then...
Not like today. Okay.
Then you shouldn't approve it. But I think the other thing is we look across other states, there are performance measures in those states which will line up against the performance measures in our state. And so you'll have a view of how we're doing comparatively with similar kinds of operations,
right.
too.
Tom, what's your comfort level?
I'm...
I'm anxious to get that case settlements information, Mr. Chair, and I think that a report back in April is appropriate, and that a comprehensive report in June, as requested, is very important, and would move that the limited duration positions, these temporary positions as discussed, should be approved, and giving gas certainly has the authority to collect within the existing rate structure, but preferably first out of ending balance before we pass on any additional costs, and would move that to the full. Sure.
You want approval for how long?
Okay, restate it.
6 month approval. Okay.
If I could,
we need to have approval.
Right, and Mr. Chair, I'm still anxious about the testimony that's been given about mediation and the effectiveness of mediation. And we're approving an administrative law judge. I mean, this is like saying that these custodians are really, really effective, but now we want a manager for them. We don't want a custodian.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I think that's something that Gary needs to make sure his folks are looking at, is where the staffing is. I mean, if we're not going to be able to afford a lot of staff, then where should they be?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Chair. Have a question.
Yes.
I'm confused, or would like more information on the carryover, which you talked a little bit about. It would seem to me that that's ongoing, but in the performance table here, I don't see any way of measuring that from quarter to quarter. So we know whether, when you look at the time frame, how much of that is carryover and how much is just the normal workload.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and Senator Messley, in the information that I gave to the LFO, I had footnotes for every one of those where there was a little number placed by it to explain what was a carryover. Not all of ours are carryovers. Just a few of them are just limited, for instance, to 2003. When it comes to measuring the days, for instance, on performance measure 2, that has nothing to do with the year in which it was done. That's an actual real number. How many days did it take a judge to get that decision out? The same thing with performance measure 3. That is an actual real
time, gentlemen. Time.
Real number.
It's 2 o'clock.
You
folks get home?
The main one that may always be lagging is for performance measure 4. And that's really the only one that's going to be consistently lagging. I think there's a couple in the mediation, but the ones that I'm directly managing are the ones for the board and the hearing division. So that the total number of days, and this came up last year during the subcommittee, I think Representative is it Petridge, asked, well, how many real days are we talking about? And we rewrote the performance measure to be explicit. So that performance measure 4 will always be lagging behind 1 year until all, for instance, 2003 cases are done. But that's the only one.
I can have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Averages are helpful, but you still don't know what the extremes are. And that would be of interest, I think. You know, what are the longest or what are the shortest?
Actually, if I may answer that, these numbers that are complete are real numbers. Those are of all the cases. I mean, it is an average, but it's, for instance, if 33 cases were done under this particular performance measure, we do add up exactly all the days and divide it into it. And that's, I have all the raw data if you're interested in seeing it, so you know, for instance, how many days it took one city to have a case resolved. But for per year, I wouldn't know how else to measure.
If I can follow up again, Mr. Chair, in the natural resource budgets, which I dealt with last session, we talked about this very issue that, yes, it's helpful to know the averages, but if you don't know what the extremes are, you really don't get the full picture. Because there might be some problem areas that just don't show up because you're looking at the averages.
Median number, you just want, you know, both extremes. Yeah. No, you can get any kind of data you want from these guys.
How is your harassment case going, by the way? Gary, would you mind emailing us when you this is what we're going to get in June. You'll get answers to these questions. Once you put this together, just ship it out to us all so we can
start that in file. We'll do that.
This is what we'll get. And include in their decision, some decision matrices or decision processes. Just what you think we ought to be looking at.
Okay.
And that'll help us all focus in on what we really need to be doing, I think.
I assume, Mr. Chair, that Monica,
you want to restate the motion?
That LFO will have access to the actual detail of those cases so that we'll know what that makes up the average.
Yeah. She can do anything. Do you want to restate the motion?
Yes, Mr.
So
Chair.
You're comfortable with what we've done?
So that everyone's comfortable, and for the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe you are wanting to approve or recommend approval to the emergency board an increase in other funds expenditure limitation of $53,580 to limited duration positions February 1st through or for 6 months through July with 0.5 FTE full-time equivalents, a quarter for each of the positions. That would be for administrative law judge and for an office specialist too, with the understanding that there would be interim reports back in April and June, and that the agency would access ending balance prior to increasing any assessments on state agencies, and then only increasing to the extent to recover the cost of this increase.
Could have said it better myself, for sure. All right, motion on the, everybody okay? Any objections?
I just wanted to comment, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion?
Yeah, that we've spent, I guess, a couple $100,000 to determine that Oregon is a state of dreamers. And I want to tell you in advance, my dream is that we're going to meet here and have a report that says that the additional positions are helpful but not adequate.
That's what we'll see.
That's just my dream. Like any other civil litigant situation.
Okay. Any objections to the motion? So ordered.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll erase the tire marks on your back if you'll erase the tire marks on my back. What do you think?
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Okay.
I think it's a lot better.
Yeah, we're
together. Actually, no, we've got sort of a...
Well, you're a top mover. So,
okay.
But that question belongs to the last
one. We're going to have a question. Or we can have lunch brought in.
Well, I don't know. At least my items shouldn't take that.
I think we're okay.
We're
going
to roll. Right?
Yeah. It only cost me $50,000. That's not bad. Mary?
Compromise.
Compromise? I got everything. All right. The rest of the
four. For the last.
I'm introduced as like a 5 minute recess. Hurry back. We're waiting. Why is my computer in mess?
That's okay.
Okay.
That's okay.
Yes, sir.
Item number 17.
Clear the calendar. This looks like a good place to go ahead and clear the calendar, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Consent agenda here.
Yeah.
Let's just get the loop right through this. Yeah, let's provide notes about
it. Absolutely.
Joan wanted to wait.
Okay.
How you doing?
Good, Senator Harper. How are you?
We're going to find out here, aren't we?
This isn't a bad thing. This is the federal government making good on
free money.
What they're supposed to be paying. This is what happens, I guess, when you get the President of the United States alone in a helicopter when the governor was talking to him. This is the pitch that the governor made. The president said the one thing we really need is money to finish the Superfund site. So the president put some pressure, I guess, on EPA, and they came forward with some money.
The governor asked for that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the president knows he's got a cool boss. Maybe take him in a ride when he comes out or something.
Thank you.
Baxter Superfund cleanup. 30 seconds.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dick Peterson. I'm the Land Quality Administrator for
25.
Department of Environmental Quality. This agenda item, we're requesting $6 million of federal limitation, increased federal limitation to complete a sediment cap at the McCormick and Baxter Superfund site. This money is awarded to us from EPA, and it's for contract purposes, no additional FTE, and it will get us to the end game in terms of cleaning up this site, which we're speculating to be done in September of 2005. The site will then be available for redevelopment in and around Portland, and the contamination that's currently seeping in the river will be eliminated. So,
and this will do it?
Mr. Chair,
obviously that's a tough question, but
no, Mr. Chair, it's not a hard question. In fact, this award is to complete the sediment cap, which is capping out in the river. There's one other piece of cleanup that needs to be done, and that's a cap on the upland area of the soil where the wood treating facility was. It's likely we'll get an award from EPA for that, completing that funding for completing that action sometime in the next year or so, and we may in fact come back to the e-board to request limitation to complete that. So those are the two pieces that remain at this site.
Okay. So is that the motion, recommend approval?
The legislative fiscal office is recommending approval of the request to increase the federal funds expenditure limitation by $5,984,524 for additional federal assistance with the cleanup of the McCormick and Baxter Superfund site.
Senator Messerling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question related. Is the company responsible for any of the cleanup at this point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, the company McCormick and Baxter went bankrupt some years ago, and the state and EPA did recover some funds in that bankruptcy through insurance. The company does own title to the land, and the state and other parties have liens against that property if in the event it sells. But right now they're bankrupt, and that's why the EPA Superfund is paying for the cleanup.
Under state law, the stockholders of the company or the principals of the company have no financial responsibility then because it's a corporation. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, I don't know the answer to that question in terms of the legal reaches within a corporation.
Further questions?
Well, I was just going to move the LFO recommendation.
Discussion? Okay. Any objections?
So moved.
Carrier? Senator Messerly, he's the only one who had any questions. All right, number 18, small grant, more free money.
Good morning.
30 seconds.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Onan with the Department of Environmental Quality, and with me is Pete Dahl, who's here to answer questions if you have them. Very briefly, we're here today to ask for your authorization to apply for federal grant funds to provide assistance to small communities. If you approve this grant, and if EPA funds it, which we don't know yet, this project will be a part of DEQ's efforts to make it easier to do business with DEQ. I did want to emphasize that since Stephanie Halleck became our director, she has made it a priority for us to work with folks to make it easier to do business with us. This includes not only things like these grants for technical assistance, but also how can we streamline our regulations, how can we provide more flexibility. I think you know there's not always a silver bullet for these things that we work with, especially when we're dealing with federal regulations, but DEQ is committed to making it easier, especially for small communities and small businesses, and this grant would be a part of that work. All of this funding as well would be used for contracting the work and also for providing grants to small communities. And with that, I'll close and happy to answer any questions.
Okay. So when do you think it'll be awarded? Do you have a feel?
Mr. Chair, I'd ask Mr. Dahl, who's been working with EPA or talking to them about it.
6 months, years.
Their decision timeline would be sometime in late spring at this point.
Okay.
We would have to submit a full proposal and be invited to do so.
And this is all you need from us, ability to. Okay. Is that the motion, Paul?
Mr. Chair, Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request to provide authority to apply for a federal grant of $200,000 from the EPA to develop technical assistance tools for small communities. Also would like to get on the record that this money is not intended to backfill any of the money that was pulled from the EPOC program during the legislature and folded into the economic revitalization teams.
Okay. For the record. Any other discussion?
Do you need a motion? Huh? Do you need a motion?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll move the LFO recommendation. I just wondered if one of us needed to say something.
I think we maybe.
Wouldn't want to get in front of the train, but.
Okay. Any other discussion? Any objections to the motion?
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody want to carry that one? Joan, you talk.
Sure.
You know, I'll keep Randy quiet for the rest of the morning.
Sure.
Yeah, maybe.
Number 20, protection from fire limitation. Analyst Rocco.
Big cheese himself.
What a guy. That's right.
Somebody sick?
Somebody is. Well, this is the last time you've been in the committee.
Whatever
short analysis.
You're
asking for.
Okay.
Short analysis. What you're asking for.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, member of the committee, our department's here to ask for the increase of other fund expenditure limitation of $13,750,000 for the protection from fire program activities from last fire season. Roughly about $11 million of that are recovery of funding from our Oregon Emergency Fire Protection Fund, which includes FEMA reimbursement, and then the balance is from reimbursement from the Forest Service for fighting fire last summer. And be more than glad to help answer questions for discussion on that request.
Roy, these things you were telling me, they sometimes can take multi-years to really get totally reimbursed.
Correct. And what the system works.
100% reimbursement is on the table.
Yes.
Ultimately, okay. Trust us. Okay. Senator Dukes makes the motion. Okay. Any other discussion? Any objection? Okay. All right. Senator Messer wants that one. DSL work plan. Thank you again. It's all ready. All right. What are you guys doing to us?
Well, we're here to report back to you.
Well, we're excited.
Okay.
Report.
For the record, Co-Chair Harper and Co-Chair Dukes and members of the committee, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm Director of the Department of State Lands. Let me hand out to you...
Don't give me one of these.
No, I won't.
Okay.
This is the short version.
Thank you. These people harvest timber. I don't know what they do with it. Yeah. That's it. They're in the timber
business. During the last legislative session, members of the Natural Resources Ways and Means Committee raised a number of issues concerning our agency. And we wanted to address those issues, and so by showing members specific actions that we intended to take. And so we put together work plans in order to address those issues. And the work plans were focused on customer service and outreach, removal fill permits, streamlining, economic stimulus, particularly in industrial lands and transportation projects, waterway leasing, filled lands, sand and gravel leasing, the Elliott State Forest, and South Slough National Estuary Research Reserve. I want to underscore that we listened and we took your concerns very seriously. So over the
first time.
Well, over the past Truly, we did. I believe that over the last 4 to 5 months now, we've dedicated ourselves to trying to address those concerns, and I believe that we've produced results on them. And I believe also that we've fulfilled to a great degree the commitments that we've made in those work plans. We've made significant progress, I believe, in what we set out to do. We're on target with 80 to 90% of the actions in those work plans that we promised to do. In some instances, we were delayed because of things that were outside our sphere of influence, such as the, some actions of the federal government, as well as an extended medical leave by a program manager. Please note that for one of the work plans and filled lands, and I do have a letter attached to my comments here from David Vantoff that outlines what happened with the filled lands work group. There had been a bill that was introduced by Senator Messerly in the last session, Senate Bill 836, and so a work group was formed to try to address those issues. The budget note and the fiscal impact that they recommended was not adopted by the Ways and Means Committee, but in order to maintain some progress on this issue, we felt it was important to address some key legal issues to clear up clouds on titles that was raised by the Senate Bill 836 work group. We're going to be looking at trying to get answers to questions such as what are historically filled lands and who owns them, how do we deal with the public and private rights connected with the lands, can public rights be extinguished. I think without having the answers to some of these key legal questions, it'd be difficult for the work group to make more significant progress. We've been working with Department of Justice on those questions, and our plan is to circulate those questions to the members of that 836 work group for their review and comment, hopefully within the next couple weeks. But I think it's important to focus on the results of our efforts and what those outcomes were because I think that's what's most important.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question on the filled lands?
Senator Dukes?
How broad are you going on the filled lands thing? Are you looking at a specific part of the state? I think that Senator Messerly's interest was the South Coast. I'm just really nervous that this may be a be careful what you ask for.
Well, we are very much aware of that, and so we're trying
to do a state law to get half of Astoria back. So
I understand. So
the filled part.
That is one of the reasons why we're trying to be careful in how we craft these questions, too.
Yeah, it would be nice to see some of those questions. I mean, Senator Messerly may know where he wants to go in Coos Bay, but there are many, many, there are many filled lands in this state that people think they own them.
Well, I mean, can I ask a question about that?
Hey, just a second.
Thank you, Mr. Actually, Senator Dukes is interested in the whole state. I mean,
okay.
We had some specific interests, but my concern is this problem's not going to go away. The clouds are on the properties, and I'm not sure it's just on the coast either. Who knows where this is going to end? And my interest is that the longer we wait to resolve these issues, first of all, it has an impact on the economic recovery when you have clouds on property. But second of all, it's going to get more and more expensive the longer we wait. This goes back to 1974 when the legislature instructed the department to resolve these issues. It's still a lingering problem, and as you folks probably know from recent weeks, there's parties that are becoming more and more concerned about it. Real estate industry is an example. They're selling property that has clouds on them and this type of thing. So I think it is an issue. If they're already resolved, that's great. I mean, we don't want to spend time on those or reopen issues of land use or land ownership that's already been resolved. That's certainly not my intention. But to make sure that we're dealing and we're moving forward on a regular basis. And so that, as long as I have the floor, I guess, that is my concern, that although we didn't specifically, well, I did as a chairman, I did tell you that I wanted to see progress, and I think you're doing that, and I want to commend you for that. In fact, I also want to say that you've really made progress in the whole report, which I'm very encouraged by. But in this one area, I think it's an area that the state, the governor, the land board, everyone needs to really focus in on, and let's get it resolved. It makes a lot of sense.
Representative Miller.
Would assume that some of the felled land in Astoria or elsewhere was probably on the tax rolls. Mm-hmm. Is the approach such that to the extent the state would try to reclaim that land, that they would reimburse the taxpayer for all of the years they were paying the local taxes?
Member of the co-chairs, Representative Miller, in many cases, auditors have already discounted the properties for where there might be question of those lands. So in many cases, they're not really paying much, if any, property tax on those areas that are in question. We've had maybe two to three. Let me ask Steve Purchase. He's my expert in filled land. So Steve Purchase is the assistant director in charge of field operations. So let me have him respond to that question.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Steve Purchase, assistant director for field operations. Representative Miller, the answer to your question is, and we have had to deal with this in the Portland Harbor area where we have settled a number of filled lands claims. Ann is right. In a lot of cases, we found out that county assessors have not assessed some of those filled lands any taxes because of the cloud on title. Second issue is on those ones that were settled where that issue has been brought up by the prospective buyer of the property or the person that we settled with, we have worked with them and the county to resolve the tax issue. And under current state law, unless it changed this last session, which I do not know, the counties are responsible for reimbursing the taxes if they inappropriately or misapplied the county assessments. And we worked with the landowner to provide the information to the county to show what was owned by the two parties. And my understanding was in Multnomah County did pay back 3 years with the past due taxes because by law that's all they're required to do.
We do have statutory authority for dealing with filled lands claims as they arise on a case-by-case basis, and we also have direction from the land board on that. So we do try that when an issue comes to us from a property owner about it, what we plan to continue to do is to try to resolve on a case-by-case basis and try to clear up any clouds on title. We really have only had about two to three cases in the last year, but I also understand that there have been issues raised about some of the legal questions, and so I hope that this will provide some clarity to that over the next year.
One more question, Steve. You're probably going to have to answer this. At one point at our meetings in my office, I guess, last year, you brought up the issue that if these filled lands were filled with material from the state's waters, that there might be a royalties issue as well. Have you had any more thoughts on that, or is that really a valid concern that not only are they going to have to clear the title but pay a royalty also for the material that was filled with?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Measley, typically when we do a filled land settlement, so I went back and looked at the ones we had done in the Portland Harbor, when we reached a value of the properties that we would accept to be able to clear up that title, that is accounted for in the settlement.
Thank you.
Okay. So let me highlight some of the major results of the efforts. Our strategic plan was approved by the land board in October. That's the first strategic plan that our agency has had since the early 90s. That represented 2 years of work on the part of staff and working with constituents on that. For the removal fill program, we reduced removal fill permit processing times and improved customer service and responsiveness significantly. If you look at the last page of what I handed out to you, this shows the results of surveys that we've done, and we've instituted customer service surveys in the agency, and then we also regularly survey groups of constituents. And in this case, this is the environmental consultants. And I think you can see clearly that from the period July to December, we've had a jump in customer service approval for the agency in a number of categories, such as processing the time that the changes we're making are reasonable, and a helpful website. We've held over 30 training sessions in the removal fill program throughout the entire state over the last year. Removal fill applicants can now view their applications, their permit on our website, and know exactly where they are in the process, so it eliminates that kind of black hole of where did my application go and what state is it at. Our response time on unclaimed property claims for citizens has dropped from an average of 137 days to 20 days over these last 6 months. That's really a tribute to staff finding innovative ways to improve that, and also some really hard work on their part. Plus, they've held 8 training sessions throughout the state on working with companies to raise awareness about the unclaimed property program. As members of the governor's economic recovery team, we're resolving issues relating to wetland permitting so industrial sites can move forward with development. A very difficult issue, I know that Senator Meserle is well aware of, that we've been working with him closely on, is finding a solution for in-stream gravel mining. That's been a very tough one that we've been working with other state agencies and trying to move the federal government and getting them to come to a solution on that one. It's also one where we're concerned about it because the Common School Fund gets royalties from sand and gravel mining for about $900,000 a biennium. So particularly for, I think, coastal communities, in-stream gravel mining and bar scalping is a real important source of aggregate. For the Elliott State Forest, there was a budget note calling for a cost-benefit study on the Elliott State Forest to look at the cost-benefit of selling or retaining the Elliott State Forest. We did get approval from the Land Board in December to proceed with that study, and we are currently in discussions with the Oregon State University Natural Resource Institute on conducting that study. And then with respect to removal fill permit streamlining, the Corps of Engineers did issue their public notice last fall. This means that if we can get the SPGP, as it's called, it will allow us to streamline between us and the federal government 60% of the permits that we do. And that will also remove a lot of uncertainty for applicants as well. So we hope to fully implement that no later than October, but possibly as early as April. A lot of it depends on how quickly we can resolve some outstanding issues with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Agency. So with that, I believe your packet includes a whole lot of other information that I'd be happy to answer any questions on. I know that we'll be back here again in November to provide you another report.
Representative Miller.
With respect to the Elliott State Forest, I see, and as you said, you're in discussions about conducting the study. When can we expect to have an answer as to when we should dispose of that property? Excuse me, when we should have a recommended solution?
Well, you met with the Natural Resource Institute yesterday, right? Maybe you can talk about the discussion that we need to contract with them. We're hoping to have something by summer or fall, because we'd also like to include the results of that as we consider our asset management plan, which is a plan to look at the portfolio of our real estate. So, John?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Miller, I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director for Policy and Planning with the Division of the Department of State Lands. The Elliott cost-benefit study is being scoped right now. We've talked with Gail Ackerman and her campus counterparts there at OSU about the scope of the study. We had a meeting yesterday. We posed some questions to them directly to an answer to your question, Representative Miller. We're hoping to have the final report ready to be delivered to the board, the land board, for review and approval by December of this coming year.
Oh, so it's, they think it's going to be later. Okay.
And the reason for that sequencing is that there's some economic and silvicultural modeling being done by
Dr. John Sessions at OSU that's very important to not only this question about cost benefit, but also to the Elliott Forest Management Plan that's underway right now. And so both the Forest Management Plan and the cost benefit study are on parallel tracks. And the modeling that's being done to look at potential dollar outputs and from various management alternatives is on a trajectory that the modeling should be done by midsummer. That will give us the basic data that we need to do the further analysis on cost benefit.
Thank you. Your question, this one, Jim?
No.
Okay, let me ask. That study, if the industry ran a study, would they come to the same conclusion?
I would hope so. I mean, we're trying to use the experts at Oregon State University that are most knowledgeable about the Elliott, and part of what we're trying to look at are what are some of the market factors that we would have to consider.
Well, we won't have to see it, but I see a public sector report, and I'm wondering if the private sector report would be similar conclusions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those same lines, I was going to ask a question. In regards to something of this scope, there are many assumptions that a person could make as you develop your models. My question is, do you have a group that's representative of not only the university and the Department of Forestry, but the industry, to review those assumptions? Because I could see exactly, I think, where you're going, Mr. Chair, that you get the study done and others will come in and say, well, that's not a valid assumption. That skews the whole study. And so do you have a forum or a work group or task force or something that's helping you ask those questions?
Senator Meserle, there's a not only is there are we working with OSU at developing the work plan, but part of the work plan will be peer review by folks outside the university and outside the departments to look at the methodology and the results of that report. Rather than impanel an advisory committee, so to speak, at the front end, we'd rather use those individuals' time to look at the products and outputs. I should mention that, as you know, the Elliott Forest Plan process includes a representative from, as part of the steering committee, a representative from Coos County, Commissioner Griffith, and we're holding meetings periodically with members of the industry in the local area as well as with the public to kind of touch bases and check to make sure we're on the right trajectory with developing the forest management plan. The management plan and the cost benefit study are going to walk along in parallel, both informing one another. And I think that will make sure that we get a good outcome from both of those.
Sure, follow up on that. It would seem to me, though, that the private sector might have a different management plan than what the public agency would have, and so that could vary tremendously the value of the property on the market.
Senator Meserle, that's right, and that's why one of the models that we're running attempts to model a management on the forest, say, along the same lines as maybe an industrial forest land operator might do. The forestry department staff have sat with people from the forest industry and bantered back and forth various parameters. There are some fundamental differences, but I think we're going to end up with one of those models looking very much like an industrial forestry model. So you'll have a spectrum of these alternatives to look at.
If we get a midnight phone call in January saying, these guys cook the books, you'll have wasted a lot of time and energy. So, and I know that's probably not going to happen, just sensitive to it.
I did talk, when we were considering using the Natural Resource Institute, I did talk with Ray Wilkerson and mentioned to him that that's who we were in discussions with, and they were pleased with that that's who we were.
I'm sure that's where it's going to wind up. Just make sure that that's on the radar. Okay. June, you had another question.
Yeah, what is SPGP?
That's the Statewide Programmatic General Permit. That's one of the removal field streamlining efforts we're doing, and the Army Corps of Engineers actually issues the SPGP. And basically then they delegate to us the authority to combine the permitting process.
Acronym I haven't seen before.
All right, any other discussion? Have the request to acknowledge receipt and reschedule the first half of 375.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the LFO recommendation.
Okay. Any other discussion? Any objection?
Did you, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, did you want to hear from Dan?
not unless they want to mess up the motion.
Okay.
All right.
So ordered.
Thank you.
Anna, you guys at work, you and Steve at work all next week?
Yes.
Okay, I'll try and give you a call first of the week, and we'll work on that other thing, that telephone conference call.
That'd be great.
I'll try and set it up sometime during the week. I appreciate that. That has to be Messerly, right? Or Dukes, or anybody? You guys are getting off easy over there.
I'll take that one if you take the rest of
them. Either one of us will take it.
The Senator Messerly?
Mm-hmm.
Alice, how are you?
Oh, fine. And I've been asked by the Senate President to let you know that his subcommittee has completed its work.
Darn.
Well, and his subcommittee didn't have any tough issues like we did.
Yeah. Great. It's every chance he gets.
Testimony
for other cases. Yeah, he probably didn't allow testimony.
He's just a member of the subcommittee. He's not the chair.
All right, 35. Office of Rural Policy.
Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Administrative Services, and with me is Jim Brown, who's the Governor's Policy Advisor in Natural Resources. We're both here to talk with you about a request for the authority to expend $65,000, approximately $65,000 that we expect to receive from a federal grant. We've appeared before the committee earlier and asked for the authority to apply for the grant. We did so. We've got indication that we're going to receive it. The $65,000 is federal money that comes from the Appalachian Regional Development Act of 1998, which is administered by the U.S. Department of Commerce. And I'm not quite sure why we get it, but the fact is that around the country, these small grants are being made available to states to develop rural policy programs to begin to look at rural issues and so on. And so we thought that it was worthwhile for us to look into that, particularly in light of the governor's interest to create the new Office of Rural Policy. So we come before you and ask for the limitation here that monies are going to be used to create the new Office of Rural Policy. They'll be used for 1.5 FTE. The $65,000 has to be matched by some kind of in-kind support. So we would match it with rent, support, whatever we need, whatever we can to match the grant to make a total of $130,000. I've asked Jim to join me here today because he's worked most directly with the governor around the creation of the Office of Rural Policy, and as some of you may know, the governor's intent is to establish the office through an executive order that he expects to write sometime very shortly. So with that, I'll turn it to Jim and ask him to talk with you a little bit more in detail about the mission and the responsibilities of the new office.
That's to ensure Senator Ferriero doesn't get any credit. Is that, do I understand that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that's the purpose. No.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Senator Ferriero, would you like to join the group?
No, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to offer some follow-up testimony.
You know, you can talk this thing to death, but go ahead.
If you'd like the 30-second version, that's fine.
I do think it's appropriate that it comes from the Appalachia Fund because that's what most of rural Oregon looks like. 30-second version, Jim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Brown, the Governor's Natural Resource Policy Advisor. Basically, we see
through the executive order, establishing both an advisory committee as well as a director and the staff to go with that. We'd start with an assessment of what are the needs, and then identify what are the policy options that we ought to have in order to pursue a viable economic rural agenda. And that would come both to the governor as well as to the legislative assembly for action. And then I think at some future point, you'd probably want to consider on, you know, if you want that sort of thing to continue, how would you codify an Office of Rural Policy outside of an executive order, and whether it ought to remain with the governor's office or in some other venue.
So what you're looking for is probably for the rest of the biennium, just get this thing started, fleshed out, then decide where we're really going to head.
That's exactly right.
So, okay. $65,000 federal funds, a couple smoke and mirror weeks positions. Okay. Senator Dukes?
Before you get all the way to an executive order, could some of us get a bit of an update on where you're headed? And
okay. Yeah, it's mirrored very
like
closely.
Not now. No, okay. Not now.
It's what I thought. It's mirrored after the Senate bill. But it's mirrored after the Senate bill, and I'll be happy to provide you a copy of that.
Okay.
Dad, you want it?
Later.
Mr. Chairman, I will not be guilty of talking this proposal to death. Just wanted to share a math equation. I was doing some math upstairs. The average Senate district has 114,000 persons. The district I represent is 34,000 square miles, so 0.29 persons per square mile. The federal definition of frontier is 6 persons per square mile. So I have to have an 18-fold increase in population just to meet the definition of frontier. And part of the reason we're asking you to accept this and approve this Office of Rural Policy is a lot of the stuff that looks and sounds great in the more populated area simply doesn't work in an area of frontier. A 5-minute drive from Ontario brings you to Fruitland, Washington. The minimum wage in Fruitland is $5.35. It's $7.05 in Oregon. Open space is a concern on the west side. I'd like to fill some open space up on the east side. So we're hoping that this Office of Rural Policy creates a venue for discussing policy questions that are disconnected between east and west. It'll work on the coast. It'll work in southern Oregon. It'll work in eastern Oregon. I hope it'll work here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Ted. Chairman of the motion, the LFO recommendation.
Having assisted Senator Ferriola in this regard, I'd make a motion that we approve the LFO recommendation. I just wanted to say that Senator Ferriola has been working in this new district he has. You've been there, too. And he told me last week, he said, do you realize I can drive all day and not get to the end of that district? And I said, I used to have a pickup like that, too.
All right. President Butler makes the motion. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Okay.
Representative Butler. 36th as. Report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to run through this as quickly as possible. This is a follow-up report to conversations that Department of Administrative Services had before Representative Butler's Ways and Means Subcommittee, and we're just coming back to sort of close to some of the loops on that. In that conversation with Representative Butler's Subcommittee, I talked about a couple of things that I had sort of envisioned for DAS. One is that DAS would be a little bit smaller than it was even as a result of the legislative action, and we have 50 FTE fewer today than we did a biennium ago. Since the session was over, I've identified 8 positions that we're now holding vacant, and I don't have an intention to fill it at this point. Even before the session was over, as Senator or Representative Butler may remember, we started to redo some of the organization structure within, specifically within human resources. We had 8 sections, each with a supervising manager. Before the session was over or nearly end, we'd closed down four of those and merged them and now have only four sections. We abolished four of the supervising manager positions and moved those positions to other work within the human resource division. And then we did not fill two other supervising positions within HR. So we basically merged and cut the superstructure in half within the one division. Effective on March 1st, I'm merging two divisions into one, the facilities division and the fleet and surplus property divisions are going to now be one division. That enables me to abolish one division administrator position. And so those are things that have happened to date. I'm continuing to look at ways to skinny up DAS a little bit more and still have us do our job. But I wanted you to know that the commitment that I made to Representative Butler and others, we're moving forward on in terms of the structure and the organization around DAS. The other part of this report was to try to bring you up to speed on some initiatives that I think are very important and very exciting that we have underway. And I've had an opportunity to visit a little bit with some of you about those initiatives. But one of the, I think the more important ones has to do with the consolidation of our data centers. We have 32 data centers in Oregon. We run 14 different networks. We have 1,500 servers. And I want us to have an enterprise view of the way we do our business in technology as well as in other ways that we support state government. An enterprise view wouldn't call for 32 different data centers. And so we are in the process of hiring a private sector company. There are four finalist companies. They'll be interviewed next week. We'll pick the winner by the end of the month, I hope. Those four companies are IBM, Deloitte, Touche, Accenture, and EDS. All are national, international companies. All have a lot of experience in how you centralize data centers and networks. So I expect this process is going to take 18 to 24 months. Don Fleming is here with me. Some of you have met him. He is the CIO that I hired in August of this past year. He has all the right experience and credentials to help us do this. He spent several years with GE, worked for Allied Technologies, and then Brookhaven Lab, which is the federal government's largest laboratory facility that deals with nuclear research and others. His background is all private sector, and that's good because he's got a lot of ways of viewing the work that we might not have had in the past. Now, I'm happy to have Don come up here and talk more about this data center consolidation because it's a very big issue for us, and it's a huge project. The potential for us to save is great, and I've been reluctant to give anybody a figure without having a company on board to help us look at, you know, what the scenario will be like when we're done. But you know, we know we can save somewhere between $20 and $40 million of biennium on this. So it's real money, considerable money, at least in my view, by moving in this direction. There'll be impacts on the workforce. I've been very clear about that. I've had a chance to meet with the unions. The jobs that won't be needed as we consolidate these, we're going to work with the union to train people, to place people. I've done this before. I was responsible for closing Fairview. Some of you remember that at Fairview, when we made the decision to close, there were 1,300 full-time AFSCME employees. We closed Fairview under the legislative date and under the budget, and on the day we finally locked everything up, there were less than a dozen people who wanted jobs that didn't have jobs. So we can do this. I mean, we're not talking anywhere near 1,300 people that could be displaced. But the reality is, when you bring 32 data centers down, and I'm going to be surprised if we have more than two or three in this state, the workforce will be very much different when we do that. As we consolidate the networks, and these 14 networks run in many cases to the same destination. They cover the same geographical area. None of them run at full capacity. It's very expensive. And I think this all grew up in part because of the way we decentralized our organizations. I mean, agencies, I think, in good faith came to the legislature, made a case to have a data center, made a case to put a new network in, and did it. And we're in a period of time now, and I think in the future, where it just doesn't make sense to work this way. And so this is, for me, a very exciting proposition, because not just because of the dollars that will be saved, but I think it reflects a much more business-like way of running government. And the question that I get all the time, the question that you get, you know, why isn't government run like a business? I don't think we'll ever run like a business, but we can be very much more business-like. And there's a difference there. Being business-like means taking advantage of opportunities, being entrepreneurial, being much more flexible, thinking about if we were running a business, how would we run it? So this data center consolidation is a huge example of, I think, behaving in a more business-like way. There are other areas of what we called shared services that we're going to look at over the course of this biennium and into the next biennium, and those are accounting, payroll, facilities, motor pools, so on like that, where under a shared services model, you don't have each agency with its own structure for all of those things. And I say motor pool because DAS actually only controls half the vehicles in the state. I think most members probably don't realize that. All the conversation about motor pool, should we sell it, should we keep it, has always been really focused on DAS's motor pool. We have about 3,600 cars in our motor pool. There are another 3,800 cars that are owned and operated by 37 other agencies. And so one of the initiatives in this list of initiatives is we're going to move to consolidate those motor pools and bring them all together. There are actually very few agencies that have statutory authority to run a motor pool. There's a handful. Others created motor pools on their own accord, and there's no statutory basis for them to own a motor pool. So we'll work with agencies to make that happen over a period of time. Some of you, I think I've mentioned that this past week, I issued a memo to all agencies advising them that we're in the process over the course of the remainder of this biennium and probably into the next biennium of reducing the SUV fleet maybe as close to half. We have far too many four-wheel drive rigs in state government, and many of them run between Portland and Eugene. I mean, it's a constant source of irritation for your constituents. It's certainly a constant source of irritation for me because I hear from you about it. And we've done an analysis of every SUV we own, not only in the DAS fleet, but in other agencies. So we know where they are, and we know what agencies are running them, and we know where they are. And my memo to the agencies this week was to advise them that we're going to move those SUVs to parts of the state where they really need an SUV for the work that they have to do. And over time, we're going to recycle those SUVs. We'll sell them when they get enough mileage, replace them with sedans and so on. So it'll take us 2 or 3 years, but the point is the fleet of SUVs is going to be dramatically reduced. We want people to have them when the business responsibilities require it and when the environment that they're in requires it, but we're not going to let any agency have an SUV. In the future, agencies will need to request to DAS the authority to lease or use an SUV, to have one assigned, and that request will have to be in the form of a business plan. It says, here's the reason why we have to have an SUV. So we're moving forward on the motor pool and the SUV. Some of the other things that I think are important for you to know that we're working on, and we can spend as much time as you want either today or sometime down the road on, is
Chair Dukes would like an in-depth briefing later.
I'm sorry.
Senator Dukes has already had an
Senator Dukes, Senator Dukes saved me from some significant housework on a snow day by talking to me on the phone and stuff. So but we're going to talk with you in just a few minutes about e-government and where we are in e-government. We're also going to talk with you in just a few minutes about strategic sourcing, which is probably the second largest, next to the data center consolidation, the second largest initiative we have out there. Strategic sourcing is all about our initiative to go out and hire a private sector firm to come in and help us look at all the purchasing that goes on in state and the state government and how we leverage that. And, Duke and Petty will run through this with you in just a few minutes. I have created a statewide internal audit group, which we've never had before. Some of you may remember we had a real critical audit of DAS and other agencies in state government around the use of, the non-use of internal auditors, agencies budgeted for internal auditors not filling the positions or filling them with people that actually weren't internal auditors. So one of the things I did early after taking this job was to change the DAS administrative rules to require these positions be filled. They'd be filled with certified internal auditors. And for agencies that meet the accounting requirements to have an internal audit function, if they didn't have a budgeted position, we went out and did an RFP, and we have a certified list of internal auditors now that agencies can use without bidding on their own. So all they have to do for their internal audit services, if they don't have a position, is they can come and buy off of our list of people that we've already pre-qualified and use those folks for their internal audit purposes. The agency internal audits all have to come into DAS now for review, and that's partly so we can get a sense of what are the common themes, what are the common problems that seem to be popping up. And then I created a statewide internal audit group, which includes the Secretary of State's head of audits, the LFO director, my position, three private sector people. And we were very fortunate. We've got three terrific people. We've got the head of internal audits for Nike, the head of internal audits for Standard Insurance, and the head of internal audits for West Coast Bank. All three are part of the statewide internal audit. We never had anything like that before. Their job is to help us think about internal auditing in Oregon, you know, how we go about it, benefits of it, and so on like that. I don't know if Greg is not here at this point. We have an appearance before the... No, this is a gentleman that worked for West Coast Bank who I thought might be here today because he's very fired up about our internal audit initiatives and stuff. He'll be with us when we do a report to the Legislative Audit Committee. But that's the point of it is we really are of a mind, I'm really of a mind, that the internal audit process can help us manage these agencies much better than we're doing right now. It's not a Secretary of State's fiscal audit program. It's looking at, you know, how you conduct your business, the choices you make in the kind of positions that you need and how you use them. It's not unlike the conversation we just had a minute ago about ERB. The two-year sabbatical that I had on the East Coast working for the Annie Casey Foundation, my job was I hired 15 consultants, and it was a strategic consulting group, and we went into organizations and looked at the way they did their work, who the kind of people they hired, who they used, how they conducted their business, and so on. And our job was to try to figure out how to, through a business process engineering activity, how to make them more effective in their work. And I think that's really what we want out of the internal audit process. So those are just some of the highlights of the things that we've got underway that I think are going to, I hope, will create the sense that we are more business-like, that we are interested in having state government be much more accountable and be performing at a higher level. And whether that works or not, we'll see down the road, but I think it's the right direction for us to go.
Thank you, Gary. Your arm get tired?
What way?
You patting yourself on the back?
No. Listen, Mr. Chairman, you've already accused me of smoking mirrors and patting myself on the back. This is just a hard day for me.
No, this is...
I had noon yet.
I had the same...
I thought you were talking about arm wrestling people to get engaged in this. My arm is tired of that.
I had the same talk. This is pretty exciting stuff, I think. So I really think you guys are on the right track here. You're going to need stuff in the legislature at some point in the future, or you don't know, or you can do most of this on your own, or just
some of each. You'll hear in the strategic sourcing that we're going to talk with you about in the next item. You know, we're financing that, and we're going to need some limitation to take the savings and pay for it. So e-government, which Don Fleming will explain in just a minute, we're going to eventually need some support for that.
Okay.
The data center consolidation, we're doing the first part of it. Whomever we hire, the first work will be the business plan for consolidating data centers, and that will tell us, you know, how many data centers does a state like this need, an enterprise like ours? How many networks should we have? How many servers should we have out there? That work we're financing ourselves. Okay, the next part, in terms of bringing all these data centers together into a single operation, we're going to have to sell COPs to do. So we're not we're going to ask you for authority, but we're not asking you for any general fund at this point in any of these, Mr. Chairman.
No, I think you guys are doing good. If it's something you need from us, make sure that you're
I know. I think, Mr. Chairman, the main thing that's helpful from the legislature, I mean, I'm going to keep coming to you and saying, here's what we're doing, here's how we're doing it, and you may disagree, and we may have a conversation about how to do it a little differently, but what is most helpful is what you just said, is we're heading in the right direction. Because believe me, if there's not some signal from the legislature that these are things the legislature wants to see pursued, there'll be plenty of agencies who will just outweigh people like me. I mean, I've done it before. I've got 29 years. I'm not going to be here another 29 years.
89 other opinions on that, but I think you're in the right direction.
Okay.
Tom, this was your budget note, right?
Yes, sir.
How are you feeling?
Mr. Chair, and with appreciation and accolades to Legislative Fiscal, I appreciate Dallas and Kelly being involved in some of this. But early on, Director Weeks was able to tell us, as we were in the process of hearing the budget, that he was able to offer up positions then that we had added in times past to bring more efficiency to state government. And those positions had basically emancipated and shown us that we could become more entrepreneurial and work smarter. And so early on, the director told us that there would be other positions. And so we said we want to report on those. And so I just express appreciation that these mergers are taking place, that we're able to save the positions, and we need to make certain that we're ready for legislative changes to accommodate the other consolidations within the department. I have every confidence that Director Weeks will come forward with the governor's blessing and have a list of items that we'll need to change in the next legislative session, and we just need to be prepared to do that.
Yeah.
Again, with great thanks to the LFO and BAM, as well as the Department of Administration's Director.
The motion is to accept and acknowledge receipt of the report. Any other positions in Mr.
Chair, just a comment, and I've had a chance to have a phone conference with Mr. Weeks.
He worked us all over big time.
He knows how to do it.
But Mr. Chair, the concern I wanted to express, and just to put on the record that I talked with Mr. Weeks about already, is that during our storm events we had here in the last 2-3 weeks, my region lost all of our power. Lines all went totally out. And I'm concerned about the redundancy. I really support what you're doing in consolidating the data centers, but I also know the impact it can have if one of those centers goes down. And you can basically shut the state down. I mean, the state offices at least. So that's a concern I have, that we make sure that we prevent that.
Don't tempt me. Senator Dukes?
Unless it's the city of Portland, right. We could save some money.
In terms of the technology, how many agencies will not be participating in this consolidation you're doing?
Well, there are 32 that have their own data centers. And so how many won't be participating?
Yeah, I'm assuming that you can't delve into the statewide elected officials, for example. And I believe the Legislative Assembly is outside of what you're doing.
Right. We're only counting state executive branch agencies.
Yeah. And I think that it would behoove us, who have a broader authority, to look into the rest of those. For example, I don't know why the Legislative Assembly should be separate. We are, but on this particular issue, I don't know why we shouldn't be a part of it.
When you're doing your data gathering, are you taking a look at those other things that aren't particularly in your purview and going to see some things that you might want to be doing or we might want to do?
We can. Initially we're going to
cast. I think you should. I'd like very much to do it, because otherwise we have this, hopefully, a good system, and then we have the fiefdoms around it.
Think about that. That's excellent.
We're actually, I'm co-chair and Mr. Chair, we're actually looking at in the first stage of this, probably just the nine largest data centers, which have 85% to 90% of the business. Okay, so we'll pick those off and try to do those well. And as Don said, do no evil. You know, try not to create any problems and stuff. And this doesn't affect any of the applications, because I've had some members worry about, you know, the DMV system that would be fouled up, and I was reminded that it was fouled up once before. And this doesn't affect the applications. This is just the mainframe systems that they run on and the networks that these applications run on. So I think it does make good sense for us to look at the assembly, to look at the court system and see what they're doing and the opportunity for them to merge. But, and part of what this is going to be about, this and the connected to the purchasing, is to develop standards around what we buy. Right now, an agency can buy anything that they want in terms of a desktop appliance. So we have, you name the company, we have one of their pieces of equipment somewhere in state government. That's very inefficient because the maintenance costs on that, the warranty costs on that are extraordinarily high, and so we're going to develop some standards, and whether we come to one company, I don't know, but I spent a whole day with some of my staff up in Renton, Washington, with Boeing executives. And, you know, Boeing, when they acquired Rockwell, McDonnell Douglas, and Hughes, went through this whole shared services discussion that we're going through and made many of the same decisions that we're making. That is, you can't afford to have redundant systems in every one of your companies or, in our case, in every one of our agencies. And so they took it all on. In case of Boeing, they don't have anything but Dell. Every computer on the desktop is Dell. Now, imagine the purchasing power. Boeing has 152,000 employees. We would have extraordinary purchasing power with just 40,000 if we made some standardized decisions and stuff.
I want to see all of those things happen. But my sort of simple bottom line for this is when somebody like the aviation agency wants to come up with a new data program that lets them merge two sets of data, that it could cost less than $100,000, which is what was in their budget.
Yeah.
And when an agency, a little bitty one, wants a website, it should cost less than $10,000 to do. So I quit saying to them, please go to Costco because it's cheaper.
Okay. Acknowledge or say the port and report. Further discussion? Any objection? All right.
We'll carry this.
Representative Butler, would you like to carry this one?
Thank you, sir.
Or Miller, you get the next one.
Well, the next one's pretty exciting. Profile
here. All right.
The uniform rent schedule.
37, uniform rent schedule.
Oh, very, very quickly.
30 seconds or less.
Okay, 37. Bill Foster is with me. Bill is the acting administrator of the new division that I've created. The uniform rent is, we're required under statute to bring to you proposed uniform rent, which if you approve it, then becomes part of the budget process for every agency. Uniform rent is made up of salaries, service and supplies, security, utilities, debt service, and depreciation. And Bill can go into all the details of that. The uniform rent is going up 10 cents from $1.30 to $1.40 for standard office space. For new office space, it's going from $1.40 to $1.50. New office space is more expensive because we've got more debt on the new buildings. And then we have another category, which is just storage. We pay we're going from 43 to 47 cents for the storage space. We've gone through all the various components of the uniform rent. We've tried to find ways where we can minimize the increase in the cost, but we're proposing a 10 cent increase.
All right, the motion is to approve the uniform rent rates.
Sure.
Yes. Senator Messer.
How does this compare with the private sector? I know we have agencies such as Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the private sector has supplied the building. Are we comparable? Are we over the private sector? Or what are we doing?
Well, I'll ask Bill for the details, but we've always been competitive, you know, with the private sector, and you know, competitive meaning we've been lower and stuff. But I'll ask Bill to give you the
Co-Chair Senator Messerly, with the economic downturn, there really are some bargains out there. And at the same time, the cost of newly constructed space continues to escalate. So we have some discrepancies in the marketplace of what's going on. On average, the Salem area study that was last done showed it for comparable to the mall at about $1.47. And some of the newest, largest leases that we have been doing, although we have a moratorium on any newly constructed and are really trying to minimize moves, but it's in the $1.40 to $1.50 range. So we still are competitive.
current vacancy rate here in Salem and commercial?
Co-chairs, Representative Miller, I believe it is up to over 12%, but I would have to check my figures on that.
Areas all over the state, Portland also, Portland Market. And
you need to introduce yourself for the record. Oh, first.
Oh, so
excuse me. For the record, my name is Bill Foster, acting administrator of the real or the facilities division. The rental rate is predominantly for the Salem area. Most of the facilities that we own and operate are here. There are a few in Portland, and then there's one in Pendleton. And so it's relatively limited in terms of how much the rest of the state it impacts.
For my question about the vacancy rate, I would assume there are some landlords out there who would probably be anxious to strike maybe a long-term deal at a pretty good rate that might be even better than the rates you're indicating. Is that something you've explored?
Co-chairs, Representative Miller, I think, this gets to be a complicated issue because we have some changes that potentially are occurring with state agencies, and there's potential for reduction of staff, and it makes it a little difficult to engage on some real long-term commitments on some of these things. You're absolutely correct, though, that there are some opportunities for some park-ins. Now, I think for the most part, what we would be seeing is we can get in at a good rate, but then they're going to want some escalation as the market would improve.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if I may, and Representative Miller, just quickly, these rates are only for our state-owned buildings. So we're probably not in a very good position to move people out of these buildings into somewhere else because we still are going to pay for the buildings and stuff. So we're trying to get our uniform rent to the lowest possible rate for our own buildings that we own. Now, I think, as you may know, we just purchased a building in Portland for an incredibly low price to house the new lab facilities for DEQ and Department of Human Services Health Division. And though that building sale was just completed, and we bought well under the market rate for that building and stuff. So we are looking to take advantage of the market right now.
Further discussion?
No. Just one question and comment. These rates, some large portion of this must be driven by the utility costs, I'm assuming. And the concern I have there is that normally with storage space would have the least amount of utilities, you'd think, and yet it's the one that's driven up the most. A comment why storage space is going up 9% in relationship to the 7 and 8% on office space?
Co-chairs, Representative Butler, this is just kind of a arbitrary calculation, and it's roughly a third of the rate of the other. Typically, that storage space is in the buildings, like in basements and other kinds of things, and so it's just a way to apportion out what those expenses are, and it's really not precisely driven by costs.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Senator Dukes.
How often do we go into these state-owned buildings and check to see
your fault,
how well they're run, efficiencies, that kind of stuff? For example, I was talking to an employee who works in the Astoria DHR building who was telling me that the heat comes on, and when it hits a certain point, then the air conditioning comes on. I figure there's probably a more efficient way of working that one.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we've got them spread all over the state, and I know we were big on energy audits when that came out from the Department of Energy, and we did energy audits. But how often do we actually check and see how well they're run?
Madam Co-Chair, the system that we have that controls these buildings is an automated one, and we're looking at it almost constantly. And after the piece of legislation passed about 3 years ago that put some energy savings performance in place, we have set up to collect data twice a year on what's going on all of the buildings. And for our own buildings, we do it every month to see what kinds of patterns we see and whether we're losing ground on those savings. And in fact, it's been very interesting that little things can happen. Somehow something wasn't reset over a holiday, and you can see little spikes in the data. So I think we really have a pretty good handle on that right now and are watching it very closely.
But if the how often do we visit the buildings?
That tells me that from month to month, you know, somebody left all the windows open and so the heat went up, kind of thing. You would catch that, but just the general efficiency of our own buildings.
Madam Co-Chair, maybe I'm missing exactly.
Hey, would you ever catch the fact that when the heat gets up to a certain point, the air conditioning comes on? I don't think so, because apparently that's been going on for quite some time. And so the utility usage would show the same.
Well, I think that, you know, we're trying to go through and look at the performance and see what we can do. Now, the particular facility you're talking about is a lease facility, so that isn't one that we particularly track, but the problem's the same. And we would try to periodically look at, with even some outside engineering help, to make sure that we've got controls set up in the right way and that anomalies are not happening.
But we caused it to be built. We oversaw its construction and its design and the whole thing. So,
and sometimes that, Madam Co-Chair, we're caused to be in the building is because employees have concerns that get expressed to Bill's office, and in that particular building there was a toilet issue that was pretty significant early in its tenure.
All right.
So.
Any other discussion?
All right.
Any other discussion?
The carrier is?
Representative Miller.
He deserves everybody else to
continue this tomorrow, eh? 38. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this request has to do with the strategic sourcing contract that we have. We've had a chance to talk to most of you. Dugan and I have. It's basically a request for an expenditure limitation of a little over $4 million. We're not asking for general fund. The $4 million will be used to pay the cost of the strategic sourcing agent Silver Oak Solution. And Dugan Fay is here, who's responsible for this project. Talk with you a little. We can run through like a 5-minute scenario. Is that all right, Mr. Chairman? Or
let's see. Anybody have any questions? I said I got a good solid brief on this several weeks ago. You guys all comfortable? Okay. Good start.
Good job. Thanks.
Okay. Motion is to increase the expenditure limitation. Any other discussion? Any objection?
The recommendation actually is to increase the limitation with the understanding that budget management will withhold a lot pending the development of the project.
Yeah, okay. We're all clear on that. Okay. All right. Anybody want this one? I'll take it.
Thank you.
Miller gets the next one.
This is the last one?
Last one, 39.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chairman, this request is another increase in other funds expenditure limitation of $5 million for us to complete the e-government program. This is brought to you after a hearing that we appeared at before the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. Don Fleming, our new CIO, is with me. We both appeared before the committee and had a very good conversation about this. I'm happy to have Don walk you through the e-government, what we're going to buy with $5 million of limitation to finish the e-government proposal.
You had the computer committee is very happy with the proposal.
Yes.
Everybody's on board with it.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Any discussion, further discussion? Motion is to increase expenditure limitation by $5 million for the state's e-government program. We got a good feel for that. Looks like a good
subject to the JLCIMT recommendation, which, and that's been received.
Yes, it should be in your folder under the tab. Right, the committee recommended approval of the request.
Great.
Good. Yeah, I read it. I think we're in pretty good shape. Okay. Any other discussion? Any objection? Happy with the motion?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And Carrier.
So ordered. And Representative Miller.
Great.
Thank you.
Well,
and I want to keep the committee informed on our progress on these two.
Good.